Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
Today, we are going to continue with part two and three, with our season two finale three-parter, the Anasazi three-parter, with The Blessing Way and Paperclip.
We had a break sort of like the way they did it on the show, where they had Anasazi first,
yes,
and then Blessing Way and Paperclip after a little break. So we're kind of doing it in a similar way, although our break is not as long as the summer was after Anasazi.
We aren't making you wait as long as you originally did, but
we wouldn't do that.
No, of course not. Of course not. It was just too much information. We had to break it up into two episodes, but yeah, we are here to finish it out for you in our mythology series. But before we get to that, Jen, why don't you read the tweets of the week?
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay. Tweets of the week. This was in response to our mythology episode about Anasazi, which garnered some interesting replies. Thanks for listening, everyone. From Jessica. Jessica says, boom. If you were asking in 1994, what can this weird sci-fi show do? Here's your answer. Cultural examination, mystery, scary science, political intrigue, all while also looking great. Wore this tape out. Right, Jessica? Yes.
Oh, man.
We're very much in agreement on that.
They really did it all. This episode.
They really did.
Oh, yeah.
Boy, they hit a lot of notes in this one. Monica Filefan says, this was great. Annie can confirm my undying love for this trilogy and for Albert Hochstein. Such a cool pathway into the myth arc and how it really strings together not only the conspiracy through the series, but also the science with the smallpox vaccine in My Struggle 2. Just such an exciting episode. It is, right? It is a very exciting episode.
Yeah.
Kaz says, I rewatched this trilogy as part of the pre-Christmas lockdown. Agree that it needs more than one podcast. So much happens in this episode, right? Mm-hmm. I saw the season two cliffhanger, and then I was sitting around a student house with fellow X-File housemates and saw the rest on video before season three started. That's kind of a nice option. Kaz also says, I think it will always be a go-to trilogy as it explained and linked lots of threads at this early stage of the original run, plus lots of great Mulder Scully action. Yes, Kaz, totally agree with all of that as well.
Yeah.
Fartaceutical, which is quite a good Twitter handle.
You know what that's in reference to, right?
No, okay. I don't think I do.
I need to educate you because this is a Jillian blooper. I believe this is a reference when she can't say pharmaceutical, she keeps saying fartaceutical and she gets stuck in it. And I'm pretty sure that's where this handle is from. If I'm incorrect, please tell me. But that's.
Yeah, I forgot all about that. So, yeah, no, this is great. That's great. I love that, actually. Kudos to Fartaceutical, first of all, for that great Twitter handle. And Fartaceutical says. About the buried boxcar in the following a Breaking Bad X-Files parallels thread, I seem to recall that there was another buried, maybe a bus on Breaking Bad's fifth season that worked as a hidden meth lab. So maybe in Anasazi, they buried the boxcar overkill in order to do very bad things in a very secret and protected way? Question mark? Shoulder shrug emoji? Yeah, sure. Pharmaceutical sounds good to me. Pharmaceutical also says, I'm also having trouble saying that word. Also about Vince Gilligan's beginnings on the X-Files, he mentions in the Better Call Saul podcasts, note to self, there's a Better Call Saul podcast. I mean, I haven't actually watched that, but any chance I would have to listen to Vince Gilligan talking sounds really appealing to me. Mm. He mentioned that he wrote Soft Light, which was his first X-Files episode, aired shortly before Anasazi, as an isolated thing and then came in as a full-time writer in mid-season three to write Pusher, I might add. Vincent Gilligan is so good, I want to cry. Yeah. Oh, pharmaceutical, me too.
Yep.
I'm on board with all of that. But back to Anastasi. I had you big time, says, I love Anastasi in the introduction of Albert Hosteen. Like Jen, any mention of a link between Scully and her abduction gets me excited. This mythology trilogy is a favorite of mine. When I was at school, I had the BCG vaccine that left a scar. Looking forward to the next installment. Stay tuned, everybody. Speaking about the vaccine scars, Erica, thank you, Erica, twice the crumbs, did some major smallpox vaccine research for us and shared a few details because we were talking in the episode about what, because smallpox vaccine scars are kind of a key part of the episode.
Yeah.
And Annie, like, being such make, a young person.
They make a
person,
mark. Yeah.
They make a, Annie does not have one.
No.
And I dare say, I'm going to guess that maybe the majority of our audience doesn't have one either. I have one because I'm on that side of that watershed. So I didn't understand why I have a scar from it. I just do. So Erica got down to the nitty-gritty details and says, a two-pronged needle was used, and the vaccinator would poke the person's arm multiple times, putting the vaccine in the top layer of the skin. The vaccine would work its way into the dermal layer, where it would multiply and form a blister, which would then scab over and cause a scar, to which Erica adds, gross. Yeah. It's a bit gross, I guess. But yeah, that now I understand.
Uh-huh.
Erica has taught me something.
Me
about
too.
My own body.
Thank you, Erica. I have been wondering this for decade, two decades. I'm thrilled to know this finally. Thank you. And a simple Google search would have given me the answer. I just have never gotten around to it.
I just never thought there was anything weird about it until you rightly questioned me about it. And I was like, I don't know. I just have it. So,
yeah.
And I also learned, I did a little bit of research as well to follow up on Erica's research. And according to my details, the vaccine was sort of generally given in the US and Canada, at least until about 1972. So that tells you how old I am. Mm-hmm. I'm never ashamed to say it. I am Gillian Anderson years old. And so Gillian probably has a smallpox vaccine card to scar too.
Interesting.
Speaking about vaccines, Hannah Fox says, after a long day of giving COVID vaccines, I downloaded this and nearly cried with happiness when I saw it was 2 hours long. You guys are doing the Lord's work. Chef's kiss. Okay, first of all, Hannah, you're giving COVID.
She's doing the Lord's work
all day long.
Yeah.
Saving people's lives, literally. Yeah, I think you've kind of got us beat in terms of doing the Lord's work. But thank you for the thought that we were doing that, because coming from you, it really means a lot. And thank you for everything you're doing. And also thank you for crying with happiness when you saw it was 2 hours long, because usually we're kind of like, did we go on too long? Is this too long?
Yeah.
So it's nice to hear that people actually, at least Hannah anyway, like the fact it's 2 hours long, because we try not to go on too long, but we usually wind up doing it anyway.
Every time we go over 2 hours, that's an officially a For Hannah episode. So thanks, Hannah.
Yeah, but dedicated to you, Hannah, every time. And thank you for the work you're doing to fight COVID.
Absolutely.
And we got a, this came in originally as a DM from Kelly, who, very kindly gave us permission to share it with our listeners. And Kelly just has a really interesting story about her X-Files sort of fandom journey, which I think a lot of listeners will be able to identify with and will find interesting. Kelly says, I'm so excited to discover this podcast about a week ago. I'm loving it. I started watching the show mid-season two. I was eight. I can't really imagine, sidebar here, I can't really imagine being eight and watching The X-Files, but I guess Kelly was a mature eight, but
yeah,
I mean,
hope
like
so.
I was in my 20s, so
yeah.
Good for you, Kelly. So back to Kelly. I was completely obsessed. Good for you. I grew distant in season eight. Shocker. I think, sidebar again, I think that that's kind of a very polite way of saying I lost interest. It kind of sucked for me in season eight. I grew distant in season eight. I kind of like, I'm going to start using that.
Not uncommon.
I grew distant. Yeah, it's not uncommon. I did a rewatch before season 10, but somehow missed season 11. Over the summer, I went deep down an X-Files hole, and I'm full-blown 12-year-old fangirl again. I even made my parents bring my boxes of X-Files keepsakes I collected over the years when they visited Dallas from Chicago in the fall. My 1998 Fight the Future Barbies are my prized possession. That sounds like an amazing thing to have, actually.
Yes.
I didn't really get Twitter until the pandemic either, but discovering this amazing fandom and the Jillian fandom has been the main thing keeping me through, getting me through this crazy time. Kicking myself, I didn't discover it sooner. Oh, that's okay, Kelly. Better late than never. I've dabbled in a few other X-Files podcasts, which are great, but I love your format, not the traditional plot recaps, analysis, when y'all agree, when you disagree, and OMG, the shipping, red eyes emoji. I keep shouting my agreement out loud to myself and find myself smiling as I listen, mostly about the amazing MSR moments y'all never miss. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I'll be caught up in no time at the rate I'm binging. Thank you for all the work you put into making such an awesome fan show. Thank you, Kelly.
Yeah, that made my whole week, let me tell you. That was...
Yeah, me too. I'm still like not over it.
Yeah. Thanks, Kelly.
That was a very kind and a very interesting story. Mm-hmm. I like everyone's sort of approach and experience with the X-Files is a little bit different, which I think is one of the cool things about this fandom in terms of when you started watching, how you started watching, how you came into the fandom. So I love hearing those stories. And I am just really stoked that we can kind of help to contribute to the fandom in this year of 2021, all these many years later, where the fandom really is still thriving, I think, and really excited to be able to contribute to that. So thank you very much, Kelly. Thank you, everyone, for your tweets. Thank you for listening as well. Do tweet at us at any time at XFD Podcast, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Mold of the internet is not good for you.
All right, Jen, you ready to get back into some mythology this week?
I am. I feel like it. I am, because this is like the height of the mythology for me. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I feel like things like really are starting to sort of get dropped and planted in this three-parter, but definitely this season. Like very important things begin to come to pass here.
Great.
They're sort of starting to find their way, I think, here.
Yeah.
So we talked last episode about Anasazi, and the cliffhanger was essentially Scully roaming around looking for Mulder and Smoking Man throwing the bomb in there, right? That happened?
Burn it. Yeah.
Burn it. Burn it like the others. He always says that. He says that a lot, doesn't he?
He loves to burn things.
He really does. I mean,
it's something to, and he's, you know, the smoking all the time thing. He's just a man of fire.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting thing to point out, because he certainly does.
There's just a little something I thought I'd throw in there.
Yeah, I like it. So I like the idea that, I mean, first of all, we see Albert hosting, who we love. And we talked about
all our hearts
last episode. Getting completely, I don't know what the word is, beaten up. I mean, they're getting traumatized by these.
How wicked do you have to be to beat up Albert Hosting? I mean, he's like the epitome of everything that is goodness.
And like
and
his
bad men come along and beat him up for absolutely no good reason. And that like that puts them very squarely in the bad guy territory from the get-go.
And the kid, his grandson, who is clearly,
Eric.
Yeah, Eric. I mean, come on, Eric.
Eric gets really bashed up.
He does.
It's just, there's no need for that.
But I am wondering, and that this is not to put any sort of bad light on Albert, because I think he's amazing, but I do wonder how much of this is protecting Mulder and how much of this is actually because he really just kind of wants the secrets unearthed, because it seems like he wants this to come to light. It sort of seems like it's his motivation here.
That's definitely part of it that he has. I mean, he's demonstrated in Anasazi that he seems, you know, very keen to help them, and he has his own reasons for that. I think that he has his own reasons for wanting the truth to come out. I think he doesn't much care for government types, especially when they come in being all aggressive and violent. So I think that kind of fuels his resistance to a certain extent as well, which is understandable. So yeah, he's not going to give them what they want for a couple of different reasons, I think.
Right. And knowing his history with the code breaking and the war and all of that, it kind of makes sense. Like, it lines up that his reaction to this, obviously.
Absolutely.
Scully, I did make a note here. Scully wandering around the desert yelling Mulder gave me very much season 8 vibes.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I thought you might pick up on that. And I was like, the only thing that was missing was your favorite music.
Oh, yeah. Which I just happened to listen to last night almost by accident. But it's like, I guess like part of my subconscious was drawn to the music. Every time I see Scully yelling Mulder's name while she's looking for him in the desert. It wasn't like she didn't have a particularly efficient search for him, I don't think. But
no.
The yelling in the desert thing was very emotive.
I mean, she pretty much, at least in her mind, in the mind of Scully, she figured out what happened to him. So,
yeah, I think so.
Which is interesting because as far as she's concerned, like, he's dead. He's not surviving that. But
that's what she's saying, yes.
She carries with her throughout this episode that hope, which I think is really cool that when it comes to Mulder, she tends to have. She tends to hang on to that. Yep, and I think that's really nice. Every time we see that, I think that's it's like her it's attitude great. Is one way until Mulder is involved, and then suddenly it can flip. And I think that's so
absolutely. And this is definitely like we get a very much not just the yelling in the desert thing, but also just there's a season 8 vibe to Scully's character in this episode because she's switching into kind of slightly believer Scully mode. Mm-hmm. You know, I just have a feeling kind of thing when Mulder's not there, which is what she does in season 8 as well. So there's definitely that similarity and that consistency in her character.
Absolutely. Very well spotted. So Scully's leaving kind of sadly, like this was a fail in every way. Gets pulled over.
By a helicopter.
Yeah, frisked. It's crazy. She probably hasn't had that much attention in a really long time. And I mean,
yeah, it was a lot of attention. You know, and Rob Bowman is the director. No, he's not. R.W. Goodwin is the director on this one. And he does so. I mean, the X-Files in general, they always do so great with helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
Helicopters always look amazing on screen on the X-Files with the lights and everything.
The silhouettes.
They look so great at night. And they just use them to the hilt. And I love that scene.
It's a really good it's exciting and kind of terrifying and like seriously like you know how we were talking about Anasazi, how we said it was Mulder's terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. That was Anasazi. Okay, Blessing Way is Scully's terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day.
There's just so many terrible things that happened to
she
her.
Yeah, she Mulder's dead. She gets roughed up outside of her car. She's lost her job. Like, seriously, literally everything bad has happened on
everything.
This day.
Everything.
Yeah.
There's not much left.
No, it's
and
terrible.
And it's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse before it gets better, quite frankly.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, poor Scully. She tells them that Mulder has the tape, which as far as she knows is the truth at this point.
Yeah, I don't think she's lying.
No.
I think that there's every reason to believe, although she does seem to be very quick to go look for it when she goes back to his office, maybe just to double check.
Well, and the funny thing is, I was going to ask you about this because she goes into the office and she goes straight to the desk and looks and it's not there if like she knew that was maybe where he was keeping it.
She seemed to be. Yeah. She went straight to that spot. So she must have known. He must have told her, hey, I'm going to tape this to the underside of my desk.
Right.
So I kind of like that little implication that he's sharing his special secret spot with her.
I do like that. And I like the way that they can sort of work around that. Like, Scully is not technically lying. It's like, she's not lying. Mulder has it. Mulder has it. I don't have it. Like, she's under no obligation to be like, it's in his little secret pocket underneath his desk drawer.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but
it's in his possession in some fashion.
She still knows that this tape is important. Clearly Mulder died for it. You know what I mean? So she is going to do what she can to keep it out of their hands,
she's not giving it up without a fight.
Yeah, which I like that. I like that they allow her to do that. So
yeah, she's in a fighting mood for most of this episode, which I enjoy.
Really, yes, she really is. So I have written down here that this is where we meet well-manicured man.
It is.
Okay. This is the first episode we've met him, correct?
It is. Yeah. And boy, he gets like a lot to do in Blessing Way and Paperclip. He's the star of these episodes in some ways. He's so great in them.
I know that he is one of your favorites, because I know on one of our lists that he was like, what was he, one of your favorite sort of bad guys? What,
I think he must have been one of my favorite bad guys.
But I don't even know if he's really a bad guy.
I'm not sure he is. I could as easily have put him down as one of my favorite guest stars as well, because I think John Neville's amazing.
Yeah, it could have been one. I don't remember which one it was, but
I might have put him on both. It's possible.
No, he's fantastic. I love him. And I wonder, too, how much like they really started to expand the syndicate, like the idea of the syndicate and the idea of how many people are in this group, especially in Anasazi, how we get that scene where it's like they're all calling from the different countries and they're talking. I know it's your problem. Yeah. It's your problem. And so you really get an idea of the scope of it here.
You really do. I think, am I right in thinking this is the first time we kind of see all the players in the syndicate? Because we see one manicured man.
Yes.
We see the man that's sort of credited as first elder, kind of the big sort of chunky guy.
With the
and
lisp.
It's the first time we see all these guys in the room. I think we saw like a little bit of CSM in Anasazi talking on the phone, but I don't think we saw the rest of those guys at that point.
Yeah, I think they were off screen. Like, in theory, they were there, but we didn't see
them.
Yeah.
So this is, absolutely. This is when we get to, this is where we get to see who is CSM working with. And so it's a huge step in terms of learning about the players in the mythology.
And I like the idea that up till now, we have thought that CSM is kind of high in this group. Like, he's this very high ranking, powerful man.
Which seems very powerful and very confident.
Which he is, but when you are introduced into this episode to this group of other people that he is held accountable to, it's it's just such an interesting dynamic switch for us to realize, wow, okay, Smoky Man's got some people that he needs to answer to here. Like, he's not just doing his own thing and on his own. I mean, we obviously deal with that part of him in the later years, but as for right now, he has people to answer to. And I mean, we have talked about before in Paperclip particularly, which we'll get to, is one of the only times, one of the very rare times that we see the Smoky Man kind of squirming.
Absolutely
is really, really great to see. And I think that's such an interesting thing that they introduced in this these episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, we see a lot about where CSM is in sort of the dynamics of this group, because having seen what we've seen of him up until now, I kind of assumed he'd be the boss.
Yeah.
But then he gets there and it's like, he is clearly not the boss. Mm-mm. And so it's interesting to see the tension between him and the rest of the group. These are very much sort of like, there's a lot going on with CSM in these two episodes, and with Skinner and the two of them together.
Yeah.
And I really like that aspect of these episodes, because there's just a lot happening. So I'm glad that they were able to squeeze that whole sort of subplot in as well.
And right off the bat, Manicured Man is sort of put in as almost a foil to CSM, there's some discord happening here that we're not really... We don't really know exactly where this began or why, but and we can talk about this obviously as we continue through our mythology series, but I feel like Well Manicured Man is kind of like the new Bill Mulder. Like, I feel like he's sort of the one who is wanting to revolt, is not okay with any of this anymore, has sort of, the scales have fallen from his eyes, and no one else is on board, but he would like to do the right thing. And I think that's right off the top. I feel like that's spelled out very early in his introduction. Like, I don't think it was like something they decided later. Like, I feel
by no means.
Yeah, I feel like he was introduced as this sort of, monkey wrench in the works here.
Yeah.
That he's going to sort of mess things up, which later he does in Fight the Future. But we will, I don't want to say we'll get to that, because we already got to that when we talked about Fight the Future. But I just love that
aspect of it.
I just love that him as a character. I think he is, right off the bat, we're like, okay, he knows what's up. He sees right through Smoking Man, which is just such a refreshing thing to see.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of nice. Isn't it just kind of like very sort of warming? It warms my heart to see people giving CSM a hard time, because he's just been the boss of everyone up until now. And it's kind of nice to see someone roughing him up slightly, even if it's only verbally. And I think John Neville is a great, I like the word foil that you use. John Neville is also a good foil for William B. Davis, because they're both just like ever so slightly over the top, but in like a really effective way. And I think they work really well together. And I think that they're great. They're great characters, great actors, well cast. And I always love it whenever Well Manicured Man is in the room.
Yeah. Same. I love all these syndicate scenes. I did write down that, like, anytime it's a little overwrought and it's very melodramatic, but I think that's the point. Like, it's you're supposed to get this feeling like these are the men that run the shit, and we should be terrified of these people, and we are. It's this room of terrible white men. Of course they're terrible, and I mean it's nice to know that there's like this one guy in there who might have our backs. It feels very, very real to me.
And
melodramatic in the same way.
It is great. I mean, these are not ordinary guys, and so they shouldn't act like ordinary guys.
Right.
And I think that they've got just the right tone, and you know, the way they shoot the room that they're in is always great. It's always sort of like dark and mysterious.
Smoky.
And
smoky.
They're always like drinking from China cups or smoking cigars or something. It just works for me. They don't have to do a lot to kind of convey that sense of like secretive power.
Yeah, it makes me laugh too. Like, I don't know how successful this was. I know this is quite arguable, but like how in the revival when they sort of introduced the new what was it, Mr. Y or whatever his name was? I feel like they were kind of trying to recreate that same sort of vibe, how he's in this fancy room with his teacup and he's, you know, you see he's in the big chair, and I mean, as I think unsuccessful as that part of the story was, I do like what they were attempting to do, I will say.
I mean, the syndicate were great, and so you know I can't blame them for trying to go back to that well.
I did want to bring up too, because I want to talk about this scene quickly where Scully goes to her mom's house, but since we're talking about Smoking Man, I wanted to bring up Albert Hosteen in one of the very next scenes is talking about buzzards, and he says that the buzzard is a large but cowardly bird. And I really just, again, I feel like I did this last time in Anasazi, but I was just finding myself comparing that to Smoking Man yet again. I feel like Albert Hosteen is out here throwing very metaphorical shade at Smoking Man.
Yeah, I think I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think you absolutely can. That's definitely a legit takeaway from that, I would say, for sure.
Large but cowardly. I mean, you know, especially the way that this whole story plays out in the next episode.
Absolutely.
I just think it's really kind of a fun little thing.
Yeah, that's cool.
But anyway, let's talk about this scene. Very quick, short scene, but I think very important. You see Scully show up at Margaret Scully's house.
Yeah.
And she's clearly just been like walking aimlessly. Like, she walked all the way here. Let's talk about this for a minute, because we don't really know for sure where Scully's mom lives. I think according to documents and canon, I think that it's Annapolis. I don't have a map in front of me, and I am not a DC native, although my husband used to be. I could ask him, but I won't. I don't know how far that is to walk from, say, the FBI building in downtown DC to Annapolis.
It would be far.
I don't think that's possible.
I think it's far. I mean, I don't know. Maybe she walked from her house, which is slightly closer. I don't think that's much closer.
I mean, she
Maybe she took the train a certain length of the way and then walked from the train station.
Let's pull this up.
And maybe that's still like a remarkably long way. I don't know.
Let's pull this up. I'm curious. Because
let's Google map this shit and find out.
Let's see. Annapolis. If Annapolis is where Margaret Scully lives.
Which would make sense, because it's like a military town.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
that would make sense that they would have sort of settled there.
Where's my little directions? I apologize to anyone waiting, but we need to know this, right? Let's just say Georgetown.
We're going to use this to measure the degree of Scully's distress. The farther she walked, the more distressed she was.
You're going to laugh at this. Okay.
Okay, I'm ready to.
From Georgetown to Annapolis is 36 miles. So
so that's if she walked from home.
That's if she walked from home.
And I suspect it's not going to be a lot better if she walked from the FBI
If she
building.
Walked from the FBI building, that's...
from the Hoover building.
33 miles. So
I bet you can't walk the whole way. No, I'm going to stick with my just hatched theory that she took the train, but it's a long way from the train station to Mama's house in Annapolis. I'm going with that one.
I like that too. Let's go with that, because it's much better than the alternative, unless we're completely wrong about the location of her house, in which case somebody please correct us. I just wanted to point that out, because I thought that was very funny.
But
it takes nothing away from the emotional impact of this scene, which I think it's nice to see Scully kind of breaking down. We don't really see that, but she can be vulnerable with her mom on occasion. And I like to see that. And she immediately invokes dad. Dad would be so ashamed of me. What is your takeaway from this scene, Jen? Like, what do you think she's...
I was going to ask you the same question because it troubles me a little bit. I've never been a huge fan. I mean, I'm always like delighted to see Maggie Scully. That part is great. But I'm always a little put off slightly by what Scully says, because at this point in the episode, one would think that her biggest concern and source of distress would be several things. As you said, she's having a terrible day. But I would have thought like Mulder's death would be a pretty significant part of that. But yeah. I get the impression, my guess from this, I've made a terrible mistake. Dad would be so ashamed of me. Talking specifically about Dad and his kind of, you know, military regimental sort of attitude, I got to assume it's the idea of her having sort of broken rank and disobeyed her superiors and having gotten what she thinks is going to be fired for. At this point, it's just suspended.
Well, so that's and what, maybe that's what she, I agree with you, but I have to roll in the fact that maybe also got Mulder killed. Like, I have to roll that in because I cannot fathom her crying like that for any other reason. Like, this is why I agree with you that I have a little bit of a problem with this scene, because literally you should show up at your mom's house crying because your friend is dead. Like, that is why. Yeah, that is why she should be crying. And it's a little frustrating. And so in order for me to sort of make it work, I have to think that she has obviously been walking for a very long time, 33 miles, and she's had a long time to think about this. And in her mind, I think she has created this narrative where she's responsible for his death. And maybe Dad would be really ashamed of me for doing all the things that he said I never should have done, and it ended up getting somebody killed. Like, That's the only way I can really walk away from this scene and be okay with it.
I like your headcanon on that, because that makes me I think that's absolutely the sort of the best option we can come up with for this.
Yeah.
And it does work, I think, because that's the kind of thing that Scully would think, that she might believe that, because she, you know, sees herself as Mulder's sort of protector sometimes. And she might feel, well, I never should have brought him into that situation in New Mexico, and I brought him there, and so I'm responsible for the trouble he got into once he got there. So I can kind of see that. And like, if I had just, you know, followed the rules and followed the way I normally do things, everything would have been fine. And so that might be, I can see maybe she's kind of, she's just conflating it all in her mind. The idea of, you know, going against the regulations is what got Mulder killed. And so I'm upset about all of those things, but the dad would be so ashamed of me is just kind of the part that just comes out at that moment, but she's actually thinking about Mulder as well. I like that interpretation.
Right. I mean, and I think the tears are about everything. I hope so. It's just a very strangely written scene. I don't know.
It's a strangely written scene. And this, I mean, of all the lines they could have given her.
Right. I mean, this is not even coming like as a shipper grievance. Like, that's not even what this is. I don't even have to look at this as in a ship with a shipper perspective to be like, what the fuck, dude? Your friend is dead. Like, why are you upset that you got fired? Like, that's kind of my...
It's very confusing. I'm honestly a little confused throughout a good chunk of Blessing Way, where Scully's coming from in with regards to Mulder's death, because she says she believes he's dead. There's no reason for us to think otherwise until later on.
Yeah.
I think she changes her mind at one point. But I don't know. She should be maybe a little more broken up than she is at the idea of him being dead. This is kind of the only insight we get into her being upset. I'm glad that they did insert the scene, because she is sort of tough Scully for the rest of the episode. So it is a great idea to give us a little insight into, you know, she's still feeling the emotions. She's just not showing them.
I mean, if they didn't have this scene, it would have been awful. Like,
it would have been really weird.
Yeah.
So at least we do have that. They could have written it better. Maybe they cut it. Maybe there's more to it. Would be great if she had said a little bit more. Who knows?
There actually is, and I should have looked this up. I'm aware of this scene's existence, and I've seen it in the over the past couple of years, where Melissa, it's a scene with Melissa. And I don't remember if it's like during this scene or like later in the episode, but I'm going to have to find it, because there's a little bit more to the scene.
Okay.
And
I like that idea.
Maybe I'll track that down and we can talk about it next time. But I should have done that research beforehand. I apologize. But we will find it and we'll tweet it out because I do think
we'll definitely tweet it out.
It adds some
we'll
extra
carry this discussion to Twitter for that part.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. Nice. So moving along here, we're back in the desert and I just wrote down they're trying to help Mulder out, right?
Yeah.
I just wrote down those are huge fucking boulders that they're lifting like they're nothing. I really enjoy the paper mache boulders. Yeah, I mean, well done.
Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing. I'm like, that there's no way even two guys could lift
no.
a boulder that big.
No,
it's not. They're doing their best to sell it as being really heavy, but
no,
it's still not
it wouldn't
working.
Be movable. They're just like, okay, there it goes. No, like that boulder needs to be half the size in order for us to buy that you're moving it. So,
I mean, it looks good. It looks really good as fake pink boulder, but the weight clearly not there.
No. It's just one of those little things that stands up to me every single time. I had to point it out. But this is something that I never really picked up on, and I might have to turn in my fandom card for this.
Oh God,
they are carrying Mulder into the hut in the Navajo blanket. Now we know where the Navajo blanket resurfaces, right? It ends up on his couch.
God, it does. And I never thought of that.
It's not the same blanket because I looked very, very closely. It's not the same blanket, but I still think that is such an adorable idea that, like, he is so thankful for this ritual that they did to save his life that he found a way to sort of, like, hold on to part of it. Even if it's not the actual blanket, like maybe he saw it and he bought it and he was like, oh, Albert Hochstein. I love that idea. I had to point that out.
I love it.
And I apologize if that's so obvious that everyone's always noticed.
No, I've never made that connection before. I mean, I knew those two separate facts, that there was a Navajo blanket in Blessing Way and that he had one, but I never put them together. But I mean, I should have. So I appreciate that. I wonder if the set designers were probably not quite as particular as we are, and maybe there was an implication that it was the same blanket, which would be cool. I'm gonna like have a whole separate weird headcanon where Mulder takes regular visits to New Mexico to visit Albert and his family and friends to just catch up with them, thank them again, and maybe they gifted him that blanket or purchased it
in their
home at some point,
or he even sent it to him. I mean that's it. That blanket is a gift from Albert Hochstein. Headcanon accepted, Jen.
Okay, let's do it. Yeah.
I love that. And that makes everything just tie together so lovely. It's beautiful. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I feel like that would make an interesting fanfic if anyone cares to write it. I'm gifting that idea to the fandom, whoever wants to write it.
That sounds lovely.
Great point. Great catch there, Annie, with the blanket situation. It's very important.
Thank you. I was proud of that one.
Nice.
So let's talk about this adorable Scully Frohickey scene.
Oh, yeah. Poor drunk Frohickey.
I mean, okay. This is one of the first times we've seen Scully and Frohickey together since EBE, right? Like,
Yeah, it is actually.
I think it might be.
It's might be the only time we ever see just the two of them together in a scene, I suspect.
I believe it is.
Which is great. I mean, to the two little short people together, it's so cute. They're both very cute together.
I love this scene so much because I think that, when I watch it, I try to read her reaction. Like, she's clearly surprised that he's there. She makes a face like, what the fuck? She's also very quick and keen to let him in and be very friendly and all this. It's not like, why is this weird guy who I've only talked to once here? So I don't know.
It's kind of creepy. Yeah.
It indicated to me that maybe they have met up a few more times in the interim and we just haven't seen it. Like with Mulder, obviously, like about a case or whatever. It indicates a stronger relationship than I think we've been shown so far. So it's just one of those interesting moments that I think you have to kind of read between the lines and say, okay, they're friendly. It's kind of nice to see that.
That's a great point.
Just the way she lets him in. I don't know. It was just a feeling that I got. Obviously,
it was a very, very friendly vibe between them.
Yeah. Just a very sweet scene. They're very comfortable. And Scully also figures out here bear with me here, Jen, that they executed the thinker, that the thinker guy, before Mulder turned up dead or after?
After Mulder was supposedly dead, like just a the thinker. This is my understanding and/or recollection that the article that Frohickey produces, the news article indicating the thinker was murdered, indicates that he was murdered like a few days after Mulder was supposedly killed.
Mulder
couldn't have done it.
Okay. Even though they're like attempting to pin everything on him.
And if they can then connect that murder to Mulder's father's murder, they can also clear him of that.
Got it.
So that's what she's thinking, because at first, I remember the first time I was like, why is that such an important fact? But it's because, well, it just proves that Mulder didn't kill him. And if it's the same weapon or the same person who did it, then it also means he can't have killed his father either.
Exactly. I mean, it's like in Scully's mind, well, it wasn't Mulder, so it was somebody. And this somebody clearly is also the person who killed, or must be the person who killed Mulder's father. And
This gives us like a good lead on who the hitman is.
Right. And she wants to prove his innocence, even, you know, post-mortem, she would want to clear his name. I appreciate that. I appreciate Scully for that. Because, I agree with you. I do think at this point she thinks he's dead. I don't think that she actually thinks he's alive until she has her little vision, dream, whatever, later.
I think so, too. Yeah. I mean, there's no reason for us to think that she, there's plenty of us reason to believe that she thinks he's dead. She says it several times, and we have no reason to think otherwise.
Right. Right. I wanted to point out this ritual, the Blessing Way ritual. It reminded me a lot of sort of the alien bounty hunters and like the aliens healing process. Like it had had that really strange image of the spirit people or whatever he was talking about. What was it? What did I write down? The holy people. He keeps talking about the holy people, but you don't see their faces. It's just these silhouettes of people. And I like the idea that like, okay, we have this sort of mythical healing ceremony that's happening. Mm. And we also are aware that the aliens have healing powers. And then we can make that connection. I always think of Biogenesis and the Biogenesis arc whenever we talk about Albert Hosteen, the healing powers of the ship. Like it's very interesting that it sort of all kind of intersects, I think.
That is very interesting.
I like that they didn't show their faces. Like they didn't show it was just like these strange silhouettes of people. I mean, they're clearly human people, but we don't see their faces, and it's just these outlines.
It's very sort of minimalist, and it has a very they seem very modern, like kind of like space agey looking.
Yeah.
They don't look necessarily like what you would sort of picture Navajo holy people as looking like. So there is almost this vibe of, you know, they're involved in some sort of alien situation or something. So yeah, I can see that. That's an interesting sort of perspective on that, but it makes sense.
Yeah, and it also kind of parallels or mirrors, I should say, the aliens that we see in Paperclip. Kind of just those silhouettes of those alien, maybe they're aliens people or whatever in the next one. They're probably aliens. There was also a quote in here where when Deep Throat visits Mulder while he's like in his dream.
Oh, I just say that I am not into this whole the Blessing Way stuff. I find kind of like, no, please stop. I mean, first of all, Mulder covered in branches it just looks a bit silly to me. And so I have a hard time finding it all very moving and spiritual, though I know I'm supposed to. And oh my God, when Deep Throat and his dad show up in these floating bodies, it's just not terrifically well done in terms of the special effects, I don't think. And the writing is appallingly bad in terms of like, this is Chris Carter at his most over the top. Purple, florid writing that is in no way anything close to how Deep Throat would ever have spoken. And Jerry Hardin can barely even handle the lines because it is so not his style of speaking. So I kind of hate those scenes.
I agree. I agree with you. I think that they're a bit much. And even though I think that some of the information that we're receiving, I think is worth hearing.
It is good.
It's hard to absorb it because of you're just very wrapped up in the really, like you said, the purple prose. It's just a little bit much.
Honestly, I have to kind of like see it written out to kind of really grasp the meaning of what they're saying, because just hearing it spoken, it's not the kind of writing that works well in terms of understanding what someone is saying, because it's just a little too dense in terms of trying to draw the meaning from it. I mean, I went to journalism school, fun fact, and we were taught the difference between writing for radio and writing for print, because that was back in the day when we had print. And the point that they taught us was, when you're writing for radio, you got to keep things very simple, because when people are listening, they can't listen to things in a complex sort of structure the way they can when they're reading it. And right. So that's the problem I have with this kind of writing from Chris Carter, is we as viewers are trying to take this all in just listening to it. And it's hard when it's written in such a ridiculously poetic way.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think luckily it doesn't last too terribly long.
No, but luckily it's over and done with. And he wants to do something fancy because they're dead or something. And so apparently when you go to heaven, you wind up speaking in this really over the top way.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, like, I usually can forgive it in a scene like this because it's clearly like some sort of vision or dream. And so it's sort of meant to be a little over the top. But I don't ever really forgive it when it's the monologues that, for example, come from Mulder or come from Scully, because it just doesn't sound like them a lot of the time.
No, that's way worse. Although I will say that Albert Hostein's monologue at the start of both of these episodes
are great. Yeah, well, because it sounds like theirs him. Like, that sounds, like something him, and he would say.
And they're written differently, I think. Yeah. They're obviously, you know, written in a very sort of like, you know, spiritual kind of style. He's talking about some pretty high level stuff, but the writing is just a lot more straightforward. We can understand what he's saying. It's written in a way that we definitely, it is the way he speaks.
Yeah.
And so those work beautifully, and he delivers them beautifully. And so it reminds us that he can write when he wants to in terms of a monologue, but these ones are back to his old sort of ridiculous over-the-top style. But like you say, it's not real life, so we can kind of try to sort of forgive it on that level.
Right. I mean, for the most part, we don't really get this kind of writing, at least in the actual show. So I think that, like, you know, in their actual dialogue and the way they talk, because I don't think it would have lasted very long if that were the case. So,
Could you imagine? Thank God Chris Carter at least understands the difference between writing normal dialogue and writing this kind of stuff. At least he's able to rein it in.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe he just really has a thing for like poetry. And
this
is like
he loves writing this stuff.
Yeah. This is like the only place he gets to do it.
Yeah. I know some people really like it. They think it's just very poetic and beautiful. And in some ways, I don't disagree. If it was a poem, it would be quite a good poem. But it's not a poem. It's supposed to be freaking dialogue, and it bugs me every time. But we do glean some interesting points from them.
Yeah, and I wanted to point out, I did like the line that he says when he said, "Fight the monsters within and without," especially since "within and without" turn out to be episode titles. The very episodes that we were discussing earlier when Scully is wandering around... Obviously, this is not intentional, but it's just
weird, but it's cool.
Right? It's weird.
It's very cool. It's just kind of like, it's a little something, something that's just a little magical.
I kind of was like, huh? Within and without. Yeah. Oh, I never pay attention to this. Yeah, it was one of those moments.
Great point.
By the way, he asks his dad, "Is Samantha here?" And his dad says, "No."
He's so clear about that, too.
But I think we can kind of fan wank this also, because I think it's clear at this point they didn't really know what they were doing with Samantha, which is fine. Yeah. I have nothing against them not knowing where they were going with this storyline. This is supposed to be the overarching storyline of the series. So it's like, but I at the same time, it does make me question where exactly Mulder is. Like, he doesn't seem to be, he's not dead. He's sort of in an in-between place.
Yeah.
So Bill's not lying when he says, "Is Samantha here?"
Yes.
No.
I guess, but it's a little splitting hairs maybe.
But I think technically he's right. She's not there.
I guess. Yeah. I don't see her right now, so no.
Right.
She's not here. I mean, I feel like I can also fan wink it in the sense that, I mean, Bill Mulder's, at least this version of Bill Mulder's role, just as Deep Throat's is to kind of convince Mulder to carry on and to live. And if he had told Mulder that Samantha was there, then he might say, "Okay, good, I'm going to die now."
Right. And it's
so
not.
I can kind of say, well, that's just Dad being protective and wanting his son to live. And so he's just kind of telling him a white lie, although it's a pretty fat one. But that's kind of the way I choose to interpret it.
And it's not unlike him to tell him a lie.
Yeah.
So
he's a big liar. So yeah.
Right. I can excuse it that way too. But I mean, look, nobody is going to, I, Jen, am not going to sit here and argue with you that they knew what they were doing with Samantha at this point. Cause I really think they probably didn't. But as long as, like, I can look back on this and be like, okay, it does make sense in the ways that we're discussing, then it doesn't stick out as a problem to me, is what I'm saying.
It's not. I mean, because, yeah, we get a couple of very sort of clear, not just clues, but statements that Samantha's alive, because we get the alien bounty hunter saying it in Colony and Endgame as well. So clearly they were going hard on this idea of Samantha's still alive. But, you know, how else are you going to keep the audience interested?
Exactly.
If she's dead, then no one's interested.
I was just going to say, like, it, just like Mulder, like, we have to believe that she's still out there. Otherwise, why do we care? Why are we following
this journey? She was the key, the central part of the whole point of the mythology, certainly at that point. And so we had to kind of believe that that quest was going to continue and that it was leading somewhere.
Right. And I mean, at the end of the day, she was the impetus for everything that Mulder is doing, which ends up being much bigger.
Yes.
But it is, I just thought it was worth pointing out. It was an interesting line there.
It's always kind of bothered me in retrospect. I'm like, you lied to me, X-Files. I just took these things very seriously at the time, or like, proof that Samantha's alive. And it wasn't. But, you know, we were just trying to look for clues. And
they
love
messing with us, that's for sure.
They were messing with us. I mean, either deliberately or not. And that's you know, that's the X-Files. We were fools to think that they would be straight with us.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So Scully's back in the FBI, and this is where we learn about her chip.
Loving all that.
She's going to see Skinner, and after Skinner's just very not helpful at all.
Which I think is because CSM is in the next room.
Yes.
And he's, you know, trying to sort of throw CSM off the scent and trying to pretend that he's still, you know, doing CSM's bidding, which he kind of is at that point, asking Scully, where's the tape? Blah, blah, blah. Do you have the tape? So that's the only reason he's still doing that at that point, I think.
Right.
There's just a lot of interesting sort of scenes with Skinner about, like, whose side is he on? And so that's an interesting
one there. That carries
on,
too. Yeah.
It does.
I mean,
so that's an interesting theme throughout both of these episodes and throughout the whole series, really.
Yeah, you know what's great, though, about that, too, is that we get to see these scenes between Skinner and Smoking Man without Mulder and Scully present. And so we get to see his sort of dilemma, which I appreciate getting to see, and getting to see him sort of work his way through that. I mean, in the next episode, he's very clearly on their side, even though Scully doesn't feel that way right now.
No, so. And we're not totally sure either as viewers at that point.
Yeah.
You know, we can kind of excuse it looking back with, you know, CSM's presence, and I think we are meant to kind of see it that way. But at the time, we didn't know for sure. So makes it, I think the you're absolutely right. The scenes between Skinner and CSM by themselves are really interesting, because then we're really seeing what's going on in their dynamic. So, really cool stuff.
Yeah, totally. So she goes back through the little metal detector, and love this security guard guy. I wish we saw more of him. I looked at his name tag, and it's R. Thompson. So what's his first name? What do we think his first name is?
I'm going to say
Robert
sounds right, but I'm thinking he's more of a Rob. He's a Rob.
Thompson. Rob Thompson has a crush on Scully, and I am here for it.
I mean, who doesn't, right?
It's true. I think it's cute how he... I just think it's cute how he is with her. But I think it's interesting how she's not wearing her necklace. It's like the one episode that she's like, no, not today. And I'm just like, okay, so you do take it off sometimes for the purpose of plot.
Yeah, for the purpose of plot, I'm not wearing it today. But, you know, I do appreciate at least she does say, no, not today. At least they address whether she's wearing a necklace or not. Because if they hadn't said anything about a necklace, we would have been very annoyed. Like, why she didn't even mention her necklace? Why isn't she wearing it? But at least she mentions it. She doesn't explain why she's not wearing it. Obviously, she's not going to tell Rob, but I'm glad at least they acknowledge that normally she is wearing it. So that's fair enough. Maybe she just forgot to put it on that morning. Maybe she's having a little crisis of faith with Mulder not there. Who knows?
Oh, interesting. It is, like you said, though, at least they do acknowledge it. She's like, not today. Like, it's at least they're not just like, oh, well, where's the necklace?
What necklace? I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I've always said that Scully's necklace is like the most successful continuity in the whole series. So I'm glad that they at least tried.
It is true. They did try.
It's just strictly for plot reasons, because she would have had to take the necklace off and it would have just been a cumbersome scene. So I can understand why they just skip all the necklace part.
Yeah. But she does I didn't write it down, but this is where she gets it taken out, right? They take.
Yeah. Right after she gets it examined by this, I don't know who this doctor is, that's like, I guess at her desk that's all going down, because she says something like, thanks for coming down here so late.
It looks
is
like, I don't think that's the office. It looked just sort of like maybe she's in a lab at the FBI or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
and maybe
true, yeah.
This is just someone that she happens to know who she called down, or I don't know. It was a weird sort of, I kind of liked this guy too. I thought he was very realistic and good character actor. He looked familiar.
He wasn't, we get a lot of sinister doctors on the X-Files. Right. And this was one of the guys that was not remotely sinister. So he was very helpful.
Nice to have a guy that just has no fucking clue what's going on, because then we know he's not sinister.
Exactly. And he's like, what the fuck? I don't know. But he seems very competent at the same time. So he's the guy you want on your side when you have a mysterious chip in your neck.
Exactly.
And it's the chip in the neck thing. Of course, this is like a very pivotal event where she takes the chip out, because we know where that's going. So very interesting stuff.
Right. And then we have later. I mean, we can continue talking about the Scully plotline unless you just want to go through this chronologically.
I'm always happy to talk about Scully any hour of the day.
Well, so she ends up taking it to Melissa's apartment.
Yes,
or is that Scully's apartment? She's in Scully's apartment. Melissa came to visit. I believe it's Scully's apartment. It's just
I assumed it was Scully's apartment, but I think when I was looking at something, I think it must have been the transcript for this episode on the Inside the X-Files webpage, which shout out to the person who did all those transcripts, because I refer to them on a regular basis when I'm getting ready for our conversations, because it's always good to kind of see this stuff written out. And I think that maybe they wrote down that it was Melissa's apartment, and that was the first time that I said, I always thought it was Scully's. So for some reason, I'm assuming it's Scully's.
Well, you know what's weird? I'm looking at the transcript now, too, and it says Scully sits on the couch at Melissa's.
Oh, well, that's not a couch.
Yeah, Melissa Scully's house. So I'm like, what are they?
At a kitchen table or something, aren't
they? What are these people watching? Yeah, they're totally at a table, and it's in Scully's apartment, I'm pretty sure.
I'm sure it is, too. Because those transcripts are usually perfectly accurate. So it's just weird that part is kind of, I don't know what they're talking about there.
Very, very weird.
Yeah, but no, otherwise accurate. And yeah, anyway, Scully and Melissa are together. Always happy to see Missy.
Yeah, exactly. I do enjoy seeing Missy. And I like the idea that Mulder's not here to sort of push Scully in the direction of the paranormal. And so Melissa's here to do it.
Melissa's here to pick up the slack and do what she needs to do. But, you know, Melissa's great, and she brings the great sort of character insights with her, too. She's calling it like it is with Dana, telling her about, you know, you're just trying to wall yourself off from fear. You don't want to know what happened to you. You're just shutting yourself down. And also kind of calling her on this idea that she's lost touch with her own intuition and things like that, which is really interesting, because we know that Scully is very, you know, very regimented in her scientific beliefs. So it's all very bang on. I mean, I wrote down in my notes, she's not wrong. I mean, I think Melissa knows Scully pretty well and isn't afraid to tell her what's what. And in fact, convinces Scully to go and, you know, have this little hypnotherapy session, when at the beginning of the conversation with Melissa, Scully is very strenuously against the idea. She's like banging the table and like, no. But it doesn't take that much for Melissa to convince her. So I think that is a testament to Melissa's sort of intelligence and insight, and also their relationship as well, that, you know, I think at the end of the day, Scully does it because Melissa wants her to, and that's enough. And it's just a little insight into their sisterly relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people wish that we had gotten more of Scully and Melissa scenes, because I think they were so good. But at the same time, I think that, like, a small scene like this, as you just described, gives so much insight in between the two of them. And I think that's something that the X-Files does really well, is that we don't need much. It's just like that Scully Frohickey scene. It's like we have like a minute with them. But it's really sort of all we need to kind of understand the dynamic and what's going on there. Yeah. And I mean, they really only give us little bits, and they only give us what we need. And that's just what they do.
There's a lot going on in these episodes, but yet they still manage to sort of squeeze in these character moments. And you're right that they just kind of like just pack in just as much as we need to kind of, and it's the writing and it's the acting and the direction, but it's little things like that that prove to me, as much as I complain about Chris Carter's monologues, he is really a good writer, and that kind of a scene proves it.
Yeah.
I like that.
On my notes here, and I don't know which scene this was, I apologize to the listeners. I watched The Blessing Way like a couple weeks ago, and a couple weeks ago feels like 18 months ago at this point.
Yeah.
We all know how it is. 2020, am I right? But I did write on my notes, I love how Scully wears denim because she misses Mulder.
Oh my God. It's that scene with Melissa. She's wearing this ginormous. I mean, I feel like we could have a little headcanon if we wanted to that it's Scully, that it's Mulder's shirt.
Because it's huge.
It's a huge denim shirt. I mean, having been a person of the 80s back in the day, I happen to know we all wore huge shirts like that back then. So that was just the style of the times. But
look, we already know that Scully has, I should say, a history. Hanging out with Mulder's shirts while he's gone.
She has a thing for Mulder's shirts when she misses him. So, I mean, I think we could totally call that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could call that Mulder's shirt if we wanted to, I feel.
I just think that's very funny. I mean, I love casual Mulder in all of his denim. Like, it's just so 90s. I don't know. I just super enjoy it.
Yeah, everything was denim, wasn't it? Now, when I think back to it, I did wear a lot of denim.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, great stuff.
So Scully's regression, let's talk about that. And we'll go back to the Mulder and the Blessing Way ritual and all that later. But I think that, like, this regression is sort of doomed from the start, because I have a feeling, and I don't know if you've ever seen anybody hypnotized. I have seen like a hypnotism thing on a cruise ship, so who knows what if it was real.
But
my sister was one of the people that got called up to do it. It was just really funny to watch. And again, at the end of the day, like, I don't know what was real, but like, I know my sister isn't gonna go up there and pretend to do this crazy shit.
Right,
so it's like, I absolutely think that it if you are open to it, it can work. And I think that is why it doesn't work for Scully, is because she's not there. Like, she's not going to be open for it. And that's why, you know, on the other hand, it worked so well to a fault for Mulder and his regressions. Whether you're open to it or not is going to depend. Your results are going to depend on that. So this didn't surprise me that this didn't go so well, but I did appreciate her trying. And she even says, like, I'm trying. I promise I'm trying.
She is. And maybe trying a little too hard, I kind of wonder. Like, I mean, I don't know anything about hypnosis, but I'm guessing if you are, like, overthinking it, that's probably the last thing you should do.
Yeah, exactly. You just kind of have to be relaxed and open, and
let it happen.
The complete opposite of what Scully is at all times.
Not her style. So, right. But, you know, we get a couple of tiny tidbits about, you know, it's a bright room, there's an alarm, and she feels helpless, and we're just getting to the good stuff.
Yeah,
and she bolts, and it's like, no, don't
it was working.
Scully, we were getting there.
Yeah, yeah, and it is, again, like, maybe it was slightly working, or maybe she was just kind of starting to access and then freaked out, like Melissa said. Like, you're just afraid. Yeah. Like, she doesn't want to go there. She doesn't want to remember, which is, I think, an interesting sort of commentary on trauma and maybe how people deal with trauma and how people process trauma. And it's not necessarily the most effective way to show that, but it is a very X-Files-y way to show that. So,
But no, I think it is. I think it's absolutely a pretty, you know, an accurate way of portraying it, that, you know, she is, you know, as Melissa kind of nails it, she is scared to find out what happened to her.
Yeah.
She's trying to get into it. And, you know, it's hard to do things that are scary, and she can really take so much of it before it's just too much.
Yeah.
So I think, it wasn't so much that it wasn't working. It was just working too well.
Yeah, that's an interesting
point.
And
I think it did freak her out a little bit. That's the way I took it.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. I do enjoy that. So let's go back to Mulder before we get too far into this. The thing took 3 days, right? Which I thought was very, very nail on the head Jesus metaphor here that we all know Chris Carter really enjoys all of the Christian imagery throughout this entire series. But I have to point it out. It would be remiss of me to not point it out.
It would be, but
But I don't know why. Again, my notes, sometimes I'm drunk when I do this and I just write weird notes. I wrote, the ritual bath? Yes, please. And I'm upset we didn't get to see that part. Like, I mean,
but, you know, I was sober when I wrote my notes, and I was still, when I watched the episode, there is that, like, there is a bathing
sponge
scene.
Bath, like
the sponge bath. You can see a lot.
Yeah.
Going, there's a lot in that sponge bath scene. I may have gone back several times and just watched the same few seconds over and over again just to get the full picture. And there's a lot.
His back. I enjoy his back. I remember the
You can see a tiny bit of his ass.
I know. Ooh.
Just a tiny bit, but it's enough.
I repeat, yes, please.
Yes, please.
I enjoyed that scene. So, you know, I will take the Chris Carter purple prose if it means that we get the ritual bath. Okay?
It's a fair exchange.
It's a fair trade-off. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I did want to point out, though, that Albert Hosteen very specifically says that he can't bathe or work or change for 4 days. Yes. And Mulder makes a joke about it, but he does not do that. He doesn't end the ceremony properly, which makes me wonder, is that important?
They put that line in there for some reason.
Yeah. Like, I mean, does he, he's not, it reminds me of like, I don't know why this just popped into my head, but like Hercules. Did you ever see the movie Hercules? It's like a Disney.
I cannot say I have.
Okay, well, they have to turn him mortal, so they have to give him this juice, and so but they have to give him every drop of the juice, right?
Right.
And he doesn't quite get the last drop, which is why Hercules is not quite all mortal. He's a little bit of a god, right?
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
That makes me think that like, okay, Mulder isn't quite healed. So he's still a teeny tiny bit dead right now.
And that's an interesting insight.
And if not a teeny tiny bit dead, maybe already a teeny tiny bit something. I don't know. I mean, I just find it interesting that he didn't end the ceremony properly. They go through all of this pomp and circumstance of doing the ritual and making sure everything, and they get him back alive. He's alive, but Albert Hosteen's like, nope, not done yet. You can't take a bath, you can't work, and you can't change your clothes for 4 days, or else it will not end the ceremony properly. So I don't know, is that just a respect thing, or does that mean that he's not quite alive? I don't understand, but
that line there, for some reason, sometimes I used to think that that line was there to explain why he's wearing that fantastic blue shirt for like the whole of the Anasazi trilogy, practically.
But he's working. He's clearly working. I mean, they could have easily changed that line to not be that. Or they could have just had him resting for a couple of days. I don't know. It just seems like a strange thing for Mulder to be like, all right, thanks for saving me. Fuck off. Yeah. I gotta go to do some work. Like,
it's a little weird. You're right.
Yeah.
I get the feeling, from what I can understand, that Chris Carter was keen to try to represent this, because this is like a real ceremony, this blessing me ceremony, from what I understand, that he really did try to do a lot of serious research into this. And so maybe that is just how the ceremony ends, and he was keen to represent it accurately, and so that's why he included it.
It was
just a little learning moment for those of us that are not familiar with Navajo culture, just to learn something about the blessing way ceremony. So I kind of take it that way to a certain extent, that he's just, you know, Chris Carter's not one to throw in extra stuff, but I think maybe in that case it was a little extra stuff, but who knows?
And it's also very possible that I'm overthinking it. I tend to do that.
Surely not. No.
You know, I mean, it's for the purpose of that joke. It's literally only for the purpose of Mulder to make the joke about his social life, when we are all like, what social life?
It's kind of cute. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Mr. Social Life. It is kind of a cute joke, and it is cute the way, you know, everyone laughs. And then we get the sunflower seeds.
Yes, he's like, you asked for them during your fevers. And I'm just like, oh my God, they're like his favorite thing, and they're like his comfort thing. And I think of like him giving them to Scully in Dreamland.
I know, right? It's all I can think about, because the sunflower seeds are that important to him. They're like his sacred object.
They really are. I mean, it is one of these little moments that you forget, but really, really drives home how important those are to him.
Seriously,
very sweet.
That is great. I tend to forget about that moment. Honestly, I tend to forget about a lot of moments in Blessing Way, because I don't rewatch it that often. When I think about it, all I think about is Mulder covered up with branches. I kind of forget that that's actually not that big a part of the episode.
But that is what I think of I think that's because that's what they titled it, when there's so much more going on in this episode.
There's a lot. There's so much great Scully stuff going on that I tend to forget about.
Yeah. But it was funny. And another one of my, I think, funny notes was, bless all these Navajo with their huge belt buckles.
Is it a New Mexico thing, maybe?
Maybe. I just love all their huge belt buckles.
I mean, I live in Alberta, and this is kind of huge belt buckle land as well for, you know, sort of the rural cowboy look. So,
but seriously, though, how how kind of them to just be like, we need to help this guy. And I mean, obviously it was more, it was like, we are duty bound to save this man, especially because they, in a way, kind of put him into the position. But at the same time, like I said at the beginning of our podcast, like, I feel like Albert also feels duty bound to save this guy because he thinks he's very important, you know, like, he knows he has work to do, which I think is really
Albert knows.
Yeah, Albert does know.
Albert just knows. But it is like an amazing thing to do that they go through this, like, what appears to be like a 24/7, 3-day thing with all these men there. And it seems like a huge commitment. And it's really quite moving.
Yeah, it is nice. It's really nice. And it is another thing that I do tend to forget about when I think of, like, the grand scheme of things. That, yeah, Mulder was technically dead or nearly dead another time. Many times. He's been near dead and dead many times.
He just keeps coming back.
Yep. And that is later in one of my favorite lines when he goes, "I was a dead man. Now I'm back." And I'm like, oh,
are we going to
do that? But yeah. It is funny. It is one of those really overly melodramatic lines that I do laugh at every time.
Yeah. You got to laugh.
Yeah. I like the idea. Let's talk about Scully's little vision because we're wrapping up Blessing Way here. But she... Yeah. is clearly having a dream about Mulder, and he comes to her in much the same way that, like, Deep Throat and Bill Mulder came to him and his, which I thought was an interesting sort of parallel. Mm-hmm. And he says to her, "You were here today looking for truth." And I find that really interesting because the concept of this physical plane or this place that you can go where you're not really alive and you're not really dead. And that was where Scully was when she was in her hypnosis or whatever, you know, like,
right.
that it's this actual tangible place you can go to. I find that so interesting. And they revisit that in the X-Files, even like, the episode that shall not be named, Babylon, but they do talk about the existence of this plane as like a sort of paranormal thing that really makes sense that they would address it here. And I really like that he said that.
Yeah, that is cool.
But it was literally a dream about Mulder is like all it took for Scully to be like,
yeah,
he's alive.
She's on
man.
Board. And and as much as I, you know, I've really knocked Chris Carter's dream writing here, but this is not as bad, actually.
No, Mulder's, this one's good. This one
Mulder's
is good.
Little dream is actually pretty good. And I love it when he says a truth that was never to be spoken, but which now binds us together in dangerous purpose. I love that line because that's, to me, that's the whole theme of this two-parter of Blessing Way and Paperclip, is the idea of Mulder and Scully being bound together in their search for the truth. So I love that line, and that's actually a great scene.
It is. And I should point out too that he also says the link between all souls by which we cross into our own true nature, which is another episode title that we get.
All Souls. Yeah, I noticed that one too.
Yeah, nice. I like these little
And then, like, right away she's like telling Mrs. Mulder, like, "Oh, I think your son's alive. I just have a feeling." Whereas up until now she did not. But that's all it took.
I do like that she talked. I mean, this is the first time she's meeting Tina Mulder, and she's introducing herself, so we know that they have not met before this. It is interesting to be like, especially because if Mulder does talk to Tina about Scully, he's probably only ever said, "Yeah, she's the skeptic. She doesn't believe shit. But here is Scully coming up going, "I just know he's alive. I have a feeling." Which I find really funny. I mean, I'm not suggesting that Mulder ever has conversations with Tina, period, let alone about Scully. But I just think that's really funny that, like, the first time she's meeting Tina, she's a very not Scully version of herself.
Not at all. Completely not our typical Scully, but still doing what she needs to do and saying what she needs to say to get the job done.
Yes. Another wonderful scene between Well-Manicured Man and Scully.
He said he just shows up at the funeral and has this really significant conversation with Scully.
And I do. People may hate me for this, but I do kind of love how he calls her young lady.
Yeah.
I just think it's so endearing. Because it's him, I feel like it's okay because he's just like,
okay from him.
Young lady. Let's have
young
a chat.
Lady.
Oh my God. It's
so
very
from him.
Paternal.
And he does it again in Paperclip as well. So he just goes around calling her young lady.
Young lady.
it's quite funny. It doesn't offend me. I mean, he's meant to be this sort of, you know, you know, a central part of the patriarchy. So it's totally in character that he would do that.
Yeah, it is. And it's, I find it amusing and somewhat endearing, and I enjoy it.
It's kind of, yeah, like yeah. He's almost like granddad for that moment.
So. Yeah, it's just funny. I mean, I just like it. And here he is warning Scully really for no reason other than to like piss off Smoking Man. Like he's just, I think he obviously, and we see this later in his character. He does not want like innocent people to die. Like he's not down with all the random murder, and he's not impressed with the assassins and like the terrible job that they're doing. And he is here essentially to save her. I mean, he's here to warn her. I mean, this is literally the first of two times that Manicured Man orchestrates the saving of Scully. It's worth pointing out.
That's right. He's got a soft spot in his heart. He's a little bit in love with Scully like everybody else, just like Rob the security guard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just interesting to think if it weren't for Manicured Man, Scully would be dead twice.
That's right. Twice. That's a really good point, actually. And when he's talking to Scully, he says it's because he doesn't want to draw attention to the group.
Mm-hmm.
But I do kind of think that he's got a softer heart than he lets on. That's just the feeling I get.
Yeah. I mean, and I think he's right and he's truthful when he says it's both. Like, all of our motivations are slightly selfish.
Of course. Yeah, but, he's not perfect. But, right. You know, why not? His interest and yours align. He didn't have to come and tell you. Nobody else in the group really cares that much about it. They do things all the time probably that draw attention to their group that they probably ought not to do, but they take their chances. But in this case, he's like, no, this is going too far.
Right. And I like that. I do enjoy this scene. Last scene we have to talk about before we move on to Paperclip is the murder of poor Melissa. And I have to talk to you about this because I feel like it's sort of understood that Luis Cardinal, that's the other guy, right? Is the one who shot Melissa. But I think it's up for debate.
I think it's definitely up for debate. I mean, the first time I watched it, and honestly, every time since, I think I've always assumed it was Krychek, just because of the way that it's shot. I mean, no pun intended. That we see someone shoots it. I tried to get a freeze frame on that.
I couldn't do it. On that I couldn't frame. Do it. I tried like couldn't a million times. I couldn't get
there,
it.
Is there something in there to prevent us from doing it?
I think so.
I tried to get a shot, but because we see the shot and then the next thing we see is Krychek walking over. He's the first one to arrive.
And he's coming from that corner.
He's coming from that direction.
Yes. Okay.
And unfortunately, they're both kind of dressed the same and they don't look that different. So it's hard to tell. But in that brief flash, we see it looks to me like Krychek just for whatever reason. And he is coming from that direction. So just in terms of, to me, like the language of television in terms of how things are shot, in terms of the direction he comes in and how where the camera angle is, I've always gotten the impression that we are meant to think it's Krychek. But then I kind of at some point started to realize everyone else thinks it's Luis Cardinal, and I figured I must be wrong. But
yeah, OK,
I don't know.
I am glad that we talked about this because I do think that it's up for debate. And I tend to land on the side of Krychek because I feel like even if later they prove that it was Luis Cardinal who it was his gun or whatever, I don't necessarily think that proves anything because these two guys were working together. One of them could have had the other gun or, you know, any of those things could have been happening.
The bottom line is they're both culpable, obviously.
Yeah.
They're both
there
to commit the murder. So I'm not sure if it matters that much who squeezed the trigger. But to me, just from a narrative perspective, it would be not that interesting if it was Luis Cardinal because who the hell is he? It would be a lot more interesting if it was Krychek because he is, you know, super bad guy and like main kind of villainous character. So it just, for evil deeds to happen, it's just more interesting if it's a character we know.
And I like the idea, even though it's terrible, that the same guy took away both of their family members in the same storyline. Like,
it just makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, Mulder, like, hates Krychek. Like, he obviously hates him because he killed his father, but, like, he hates him. And so the idea that, like, I mean, Scully, as far as we know, at least when we get on to, I think, is it Piper Morro or is it Apocrypha? One of those. Where she figures out that it's Luis Cardinal who did it. As far as she's concerned, he's the one who did it. But like, I still want to be like, I don't know, Scully.
I always thought it was Krychek, and I could never get my head around anything else.
But like you said, they're both culpable. They're both there to do it. So potato, potato. But I did want to point that out because I thought I was the only one in the world who thought it was Krychek. So it's nice to hear.
No, I always thought it was him.
Yeah. But I'm not. All right, well, let's move on. Paperclip.
Paperclip! So Blessing Way ends on this big sort of cliffhanger.
Oh, you're right. There was one more scene.
Scully and Skinner in Mulder's apartment for some reason. I mean, for the reasons of Mulder's dramatic entrance, really. Mm-hmm. But it's a great little cliffhanger that it ends on. It's so tense.
Yeah, didn't he say, like, we have to go somewhere safe? And then he took her there?
Yeah, like, somewhere we can talk or something. And I'm like, you could have talked in the car if you were looking for somewhere private.
And
why did you have to go to his apartment?
It was a little weird, right?
I mean, I guess... little weird, but that's where we got to see Scully's little key with Mulder.
Right,
which
yeah.
So at least we have that.
We do know for sure that it's empty. So there's that.
Like, yeah, that's true.
They know they're not going to be interrupted. Nobody's there. But
it's a bit of a straight. I mean, I guess it's like neutral turf. Maybe Scully thought she'd feel more comfortable there. But again, once she gets into the car, you might as well just have the conversation in the car.
Yeah.
If he's truly there just to kind of say, I have the digital tape, and to hand it to her, or just to tell her he has it, you could have done that in the car. You didn't have to go all the way over to Mulder's place. But like I say, it's really just so Mulder can make that fantastic entrance at the start of Paperclip.
Yeah. And I mean, there was like, he had to intercept her because she was obviously on her way to find Melissa and edit it.
She's on her way to find it's
to find her on the street, apparently.
Yeah, I'm gonna
with her head hanging out the window like a dog looking for her. I always am like, what?
Like, how is that gonna work? I mean, I don't want to throw any guilt on top of Scully's already existent guilt, but
no.
I always kind of blame Scully for Melissa's being killed because Scully knows there's someone coming to get her, that her place is a dangerous place to be, so much so that she decides that she wants to meet Melissa at her place instead.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to look for her on the way,
yeah,
which apparently she thinks is going to work. But then she just gets into Skinner's car and thinks, okay, well, Melissa will figure it out. But she had to know that Melissa would go into her apartment. She obviously has a key to Scully's apartment.
Right.
She had to know that was going to happen.
Right.
So I'm just a tiny bit mad at Scully about it. I'm sorry.
You're right. I hate it, but you're right. Like,
it just bothers me.
She should, or I mean, the only way that I can square that is to think that maybe in that moment she didn't take Well Manicured Man as seriously as maybe she should have.
Yeah.
And then later, obviously, she felt guilty about it because she was. At the end of Paperclip, she was just like, never even knew how sorry I was. Like, but I mean, I do obviously do not blame Scully for Melissa's death, but I think it was preventable, though. I think it was.
I just feel like she wasn't being as cautious as she should have been. And it's just very unfortunate the way things went. But yeah, at that moment, she probably thought, okay, I'm probably being paranoid.
Yeah.
There's probably not someone out to get me. Melissa will be fine. She'll get here. She'll find I'm not here. She'll probably go back home to her place. And I mean, I guess no one's carrying cell phones at this point, which would have been really handy if they had them.
It would have been.
But, you know, I guess in her mind, it's like, okay, I'm just being silly. That's not a legitimate threat. Whereas what's going on with Skinner at this moment, it's happening right in front of me. That's important. Let's go with that. So
yeah, absolutely.
We can certainly excuse it, but it still just, it just makes me feel slightly unsettled.
Yeah, I agree.
But it's okay. I don't blame you, Scully.
No. It is what it is. And it's unfortunate, and it's part of, you know, the line of work that they're in, I guess.
She can't always make the right call. There's a lot of shit going on in her life, and she is having a really bad day.
It is the worst day. It really is. God.
So I can forgive her.
Yeah. So the standoff ends in Paperclip with Mulder very, very dramatically bursting into the apartment.
That's so great. I love that.
I do enjoy how his first question is like, you okay, Scully? Like, she's like, you were dead, bro.
She's like, mouth is literally hanging open.
But thank you for asking how I am. Precious Mulder always is concerned.
Yeah, I do love that. It's great. It just, because I mean, you know, at the time, it's kind of, it didn't occur to me that it was going to be Mulder at the time, because the last we saw of him, he was visiting his mother. And so we had no reason to think that he was back, although probably if I'd thought about it, I should have realized it was going to be him. It's his apartment. But because of this Well-Manicured Man's warning that it would be two men would perhaps be the ones who would come after her. So the idea that there was another guy outside who was going to kill her would make total sense based on his warning. So that's kind of what it did seem like. It was going to be a sinister presence.
And she's thinking like, oh, and it could be someone close to you. So maybe she's thinking Skinner, like, oh,
very wound up. She's wound up about Skinner. Now there's someone mysterious outside in the hallway. It's all very scary.
Right.
And
then
it turns out to be Mulder, and it's all great.
It's all good.
I mean, I love the moment when Skinner says, I have the digital tape, because that's the moment when it's like, crystal clear he's on their side.
Yeah.
Because up until then, we didn't know where the digital tape was. And it never would have occurred to me that it was Skinner that had it all along. And so as soon as he says that, it's like, oh, shit, you know, things just turned around all of a sudden. And that's really interesting.
So did he, like, ransack their office, or was he watching them? Or, like, how did he get it? That's my question.
I don't know. I mean, maybe he always knew where that secret special hidey place was too, or maybe it wasn't that hard to find, so maybe he did
kind of around the office, peek and snoop through the desk,
and it wouldn't, you know, the idea of feeling underneath the desk is probably a pretty standard place to check, I guess so.
Yeah,
that's my guess,
at least from all the movies and TV we've watched. That's definitely standard procedure.
Absolutely.
I should mention the cold open of this was about the white buffalo calf, because,
oh yeah, that's cool.
I have to bring that up because the idea of the white buffalo carries all the way through, and it seems to be very associated with William. Even if you remember the farm that they take him to, there's a flag with a white buffalo on it, and then the mobile has the white buffaloes. It's just very interesting, and then there's a lot of there's the calf, like the idea of the calf not drinking its mother's milk, like it refused to drink its mother's milk, and then the mother laid down and died. And I am not suggesting that this is something that they planned, but it is just worth pointing out how it parallels what happens later with William. The idea of she gives him up. He's no longer drinking his mother's milk, and then she just lays down. And it just made me pause, because when I hear about the white buffalo calf, it was born after Mulder was healed, which was sort of like the symbol of, like, okay, this Mulder is getting this second chance, this rebirth or whatever. And this association with William and Mulder, and then the association with the white buffalo calf later with William. It could just be a bunch of nonsense, Jen, but I had to point it out because it's definitely something that either David Duchovny chose to bring back in that episode, or Chris Carter chose to bring back in that episode. So it's something that has meaning.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the white buffalo is very clearly and plainly used as a symbol in William, for sure.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it's very interesting. Obviously it's something that they wanted to go back to. It was sort of a symbol that was interesting enough to bring it back, which is, I mean, I love that idea that they reached all the way back just to the beginning of season 3.
Yeah.
When they were doing something in season 9. So I think that's cool, because, I mean, how many people even watching that in season 9 had any clue where that was from? Because they didn't draw any attention to it. It was just there.
No, and it was there very briefly. Yeah, exactly. Just a really cool little Easter egg. And just the idea that, like, Albert Hochstein is talking about it, and he says that it's an omen for great change, which, again, is very valid. A use for it later. And I wanted to give a shout out to Mark Snow for this music, because I think all of the music during Albert Hochstein's, like, monologues, I think, is just very evocative, very beautiful. I really love it.
Yeah. It's great. Albert, you know, that's Floyd Red Crow Westerman, I want to say.
Yeah.
Westerman, thank you. His voice is so great, and he does a really great job with reading, and then the music together. It is like I could listen to that all day long. Mm-hmm. I could listen to a whole album of him reading that stuff with that music, because it's just so good.
It really is. Well done. Well done all around there. I feel the scene, shifting gears here to poor Maggie, who's so sure that Scully has been shot. Maggie. To only find out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not only is her other daughter been shot and is in critical condition, she has no idea where Scully is. Like.
Yeah. So now it's like both of her daughters are actually in danger now.
Poor Maggie. Like, I seriously was just like,
she has to go through it.
Yeah. This entire episode, she is going through it.
Thank goodness Albert is there for her.
I do love when he shows up. And I mean, it's like he's like, someone told me to be here. And I always wondered who that was, or if it was just his own, like.
Yeah.
Was it Skinner?
I always thought it was, I think it was Mulder, because doesn't Mulder say something to Scully when she's in distress, when she finds out that Melissa's in the hospital and she wants to go and see her, and Mulder's talking her out of it? He says something like, I think I know someone who can help, or something like that.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So I took that to mean that he contacted Albert. Albert, being like the champion he is, apparently just jumped on a plane and came straight to Washington to help out, no questions asked. shows up and does his thing. I mean, I remember thinking, I mean, I was watching this again this week. I was thinking, man, if I was in the hospital, Albert Einstein is exactly who I'd want to see show up, because he just seems like he would be a great comfort in trying times.
He really would be such a calming presence. I agree. And I can think
him.
Maggie, all while slightly skeptical of this stranger coming in and like doing a ritual over her, I think does appear sort of grateful to have somebody there. And he mentions Scully, and he mentions that he's there to help. And it is a nice little random thing to have happen, and I enjoy it.
Absolutely. I'm glad that she's got someone there to keep her company, at least, because she would have been all on her own otherwise. And so I'm glad that he's there to sort of keep watch over the Scully women.
Yeah. So Mulder and Scully on the case here at this point, and they're with the lone gunman. Yay! We have the lone gunman. Yay!
We got the lone gunman. The paperclip just has it all. And we even get the lone gunman in there. A great little lone gunman scene.
And we're even rewarded with a little Frohickey hug, because the last time we saw Frohickey, he was drinking himself because he was so depressed that Mulder was dead. And now he's
so
like,
sad.
Yeah, now he's just allowed to have huggies. And so I enjoy
it. It's so sweet. Yeah. Just like, wow, their height difference is really obvious in that hug, too, in terms of Mulder and Frohickey.
I recently pointed out on Twitter the parallel between this is the first, again, of two times where Frohickey thinks Mulder is dead, finds out he then isn't, and gives him a big huggy. So it's very true. Again, at least just they just keep calling back, and I love all the callbacks.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just lovely. So they learn here from Byers and Langley primarily about Operation Paperclip, which was all of these sort of Nazi war criminals who were essentially given, they call it a deal with the devil, to help develop these, or do these experiments and develop these hybrids in exchange for, I guess, some sort of amnesty. Anyway, this is apparently like a real thing. I believe it is. Yeah,
yeah.
It's not like obviously, I mean, I don't want to say obviously because we don't know what kind of experiments they were doing, but it wasn't. It's not going to be said that it's alien experiments, but there was definitely experiments happening.
I think a good part of what they tell us is true.
Yeah. Victor Klemper was actually a real name I found, like a real person. So I thought that was interesting.
Although he wasn't a Nazi.
No, it was like he's actually a
Jew who survived, who escaped Germany at the time in World War II. So it's an interesting choice to name this guy Victor Klemper based on that. But for whatever reason, they did.
Yeah, it was very weird. I remember being very confused when I was reading up on this, and it was several weeks ago.
It's a bit confusing. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do remember thinking that was really weird.
I don't know what to make of that.
Interesting, though.
But
I do think it's one of the things I wanted to point out, too, was I love this shot. And I noticed this the last time I watched Paperclip. Well, a couple of years ago when I watched Paperclip. When Mulder points, he's looking at the photo of all the men, and he points to Bill, and he says, "That's my father on the left there." But Smoking Man is the one on the far left. Which I think...
I never noticed that.
Again, if it's not intentional, it's just fucking brilliant. And it's a wonderful coincidence. I think it's very possible that they already had in mind that Smoking Man might be Mulder's father at this point, because we do get that indication at the end of this season. So it's not much further along that we learn.
No, absolutely. I think you're right that they could have been thinking that easily at this point. And I never thought of that moment before, but it's a great moment. No matter what the sort of history behind it is, it's a great bit of foreshadowing, intentional or otherwise.
Absolutely. Every time I see it now, I just think of it. I go, oh, that's so cool. Like, he is on the left, but Mulder doesn't know it. It's lovely.
Yeah, that's very cool. I'm going to have to watch that part again now.
It's really cool. So this is where Scully, though, learns about Melissa's death, or not death, about her critical condition.
But she's in the hospital. Yeah.
And of course
Frohickey.
Frohickey, yeah. And of course she runs immediately, and Mulder has to stop her. And Mulder is right. Like, as much as I kind of don't want Mulder to stop her, he's right. Like, if you go there, you're going to be in danger. And it's like, there's nothing wrong about what she's saying. But I do think it's interesting that he says to her, the only thing you can do for her right now is to try to crucify them. Because my immediate reaction to that was, Mulder, have you learned nothing from One Breath?
Yeah. Yeah, seriously, right?
I thought you had a big moment. And again, this is just me chalking it up to like Mulder really can only see straight when it comes to Scully, when it comes to his own situation with Scully, like any sort of external situation going on. And that's, I feel like that's so often the case. Like we were just talking about this, that they can't see past their own sort of way of seeing things unless they're dealing directly with each other, which I just find fascinating. Yeah. But it is pretty much the opposite of what he learned from from One Breath. So I was just kind of like,
we'll ascribe it to sort of a stressful time. Yeah. So
it was just,
he was almost dead. So
it was a very Mulder thing to say, but at the same time, it totally was. Come on, that's not helpful. Come on.
Yes.
But, So we have this scene where they go see Victor Klemper in his little greenhouse. Yeah. And he's...
Which is a very... I mean, I love both of the scenes in that greenhouse. It's very... The flowers are gorgeous.
It's a great location.
Great location, beautifully shot and really cool. And the guy playing Victor Klemper is terrific. That whole scene is really very sinister and interesting.
Yeah. I like the sort of undercurrents of like just... it's awkward and it's like they're both really hating this guy, but they have to get this information out. And then I do wonder his relationship with the syndicate, because he's clearly out in the same way I assume that Bill Mulder was out. But he's still in contact with them. Like he calls up Well Manicured Man and he's like, oh, my old friend, I haven't talked to you in many, many years.
Yes. But they still seem friendly towards one another.
Right. At least the two of them do.
Yeah.
And I do think it's interesting that the idea of Strughold is introduced here, because Strughold minds, we don't know what that means at this point, but in Fight the Future we actually get to meet Strughold, who is a real person who we can now associate with these mining buildings, and again with the great locations. This whole episode is just full of amazing locations.
Mine. The mine is awesome.
Yeah. So let's go there, Jen. What do you think?
Yeah, to the mine.
Where there are lots and lots of files.
Lots and lots of files. Mm-hmm. That's like my favorite line ever on the X-Files. I can't explain why it delights me so, but it really does. Lots and lots of files. I mean, I work as an admin assistant, and so I have to deal with files a lot. So the number of times I mutter to myself in the course of my workday, lots and lots of files. It just entertains me. It entertains me when I'm filing.
I get that. It would amuse me as well. So I completely appreciate it. I think it's interesting how Scully kind of has pause and she's like, are you sure that you want to go in here and find out, you know, you could learn some sort of truth about your father that might, and
it's thoughtful.
Yeah, it is thoughtful. And I think it's interesting how we sort of keep the idea of Scully's relationship with her father alive. We continue to do that. Like, and that doesn't stop. Like that continues to stay as part of the narrative for a while. I mean, it shapes Scully as a character, is like how she feels about her father and how their relationship was. And I just find that really interesting whenever they bring it back.
It's cool. It's a cool little callback there. And it is kind of a nice moment where Scully's thinking of Mulder and being sort of like looking out for him as she always does.
Mm-hmm.
And fun fact as well that I think a lot of people know already, Scully's wrong about Napier's constant. That's not actually Napier's constant. That's because that's the clue that they get from Victor Klemper,
right?
The code to get for the door. And so they're all 27828, right? And Scully's like, yeah, that's definitely Napier's constant. And I'm sure I remember hearing somewhere along the line someone saying, no, it's not. And so I had to look it up. And yeah, no. Napier's constant is 271828. So they left a digit out. That might have been why it wasn't working on any of the doors.
Oh, but my God. Well, at least
it actually does work.
At
so,
least it's consistent, I mean, that she didn't.
Yeah,
know it.
I think whoever was writing it for whatever reason just left a digit out for some reason. Or maybe it was just, it's just awkward to say 271828. It's a lot easier to say 27828. So they may have just decided to shorten it for the purposes of dialogue. I don't know, but for whatever reason, that's actually not Napier's constant.
Oh my
it's
God.
Almost, but not quite.
That,
Napier's constant.
That drives me crazy. That's going to drive me crazy.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, thanks a lot. let's just say that Mulder knew it for some reason and Scully misspoke.
There was just a little,
a little miscommunication there.
A little miscommunication, but they're actually typing in the correct one.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's go with that. Yeah.
The only way out of that is that Mulder actually knew it. And
Scully was Scully-splaining to him, and he actually knew it. Let's go with that.
That's a darling ball.
So this is where we find out, although it is worth mentioning that the first thing Mulder wants to do is look at Scully's file. Like, once they figure out that there's all these files, his first thing is, when's your birthday?
I love that bit. It's almost my, I love this episode a lot, and I love that moment in the episode where, first, you know, they're looking at these files from 1955, and Mulder says, when was this person born? Scully says 1955. And then when Mulder says, what year were you born? That's, to me, like this amazing moment in the episode where things just take this sudden, unexpected turn. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did have a little hint in Anasazi that there was something about Scully in those files, so that, you know, we've been talking about her abduction. But the fact that he immediately says, what year were you born? It's like, oh, this just got a lot more interesting for me. This isn't just about random files of people that we don't know all of a sudden. Now it's like, and there's just something about the way that Mulder says it. There's just a little bit of emotion behind it. He's just concerned. And obviously Scully kind of freaks out a little bit about it. And it's just kind of a very sort of intense sort of moment as he's running to look for her file. And of course he finds it because she was one of the victims of whatever's going on here.
Yeah, and he knows. Like, you could tell that he's already prepared for this. Like, he and again, later, like, you can see his frustration with her when he's like, how are you not connecting these dots? Like, you were an abductee. Your stuff's in there. Like, but I mean, I had this conversation recently with a friend that was like, are all of these people abductees? And I'm like, no, not necessarily. Like, Mulder was Samantha was there. She was an abductee. But I assume that, like, not every single file in this entire building is an abductee. I feel like it's just...
No, I don't think so.
All of the smallpox vaccinations are kept on record in here. But what was different about Scully's is the fact that there was a recent sample.
Yes, and they made a point of that.
Yeah, they made a point to point out that, like, yeah, this isn't just some old smallpox vaccination. There is something here that is recent because you were taken. Like, hello, Scully. Like, see, these are the people that took you. This is all connected. Like, so it's just interesting.
I think Mulder handles it very sort of sensitively, because it's like Scully's like, how can there be a recent tissue sample here? And Mulder could have been like, duh, because you were just abducted. But he knows she's not necessarily ready to hear that right at that moment. So he just kind of glosses over it a little bit, which is, you know, fair enough.
I think it's like he's giving her time and the opportunity to sort of put the pieces together. But by the end of the episode, he's like had enough. He's like,
just can't hold back any longer. It's like,
I gave you your time. Yeah. And so I enjoy that. But after they find Scully, he immediately again goes to find Samantha because that's where he would naturally go. Yeah. And this is where we find out that it was originally supposed to be him. And it was covered up with Samantha's name, which
so we had met Samantha. You can see that her label is on top of another label, and he can peel her label off, and there's his name,
right? And it's interesting because does that mean that he does not exist in these files anywhere? Or because I always feel that, like, the whole label coming off thing is sort of just for dramatic effect. Like, it's not, you know what I mean, it's not necessarily like, okay, there isn't another file in here with Mulder, because there might be, but it's a way to show us, the viewer, in one very quick, easy shot, exactly what went on here it was him and he was replaced. Like, he was, and so in terms of, like, that wasn't actually his file. It was just like, they didn't, like, pick out a file and, like, put a sticker on it and be like, wait, nope, changed our mind, put another sticker on it. Like,
I think that's,
you know,
what we're supposed to think they did, but
but it's just like, I think that rather than thinking of it like that, I just kind of am like, okay, this seems to be just kind of a clever storytelling device to show
it
us.
I mean, I think we still have to buy to the fact that, you know, they just didn't have, I mean, despite the lots and lots of files, I guess they really had to be careful with the number of folders that they used.
Yeah, I guess so.
You got to reuse those babies. They're expensive. And so, just put another label on it. But it is like you say, it's a storytelling technique and a very effective
one. It's very effective. It gets across the information.
Oh my God, this was meant to be me. Yeah. So it works, you know, it's a bit silly, but mm-hmm. it does work for the purposes of what they're trying to convey.
It gets the information across, exactly. So
it does. And, you know, there's a lot of information in this episode. So yeah. boom, bam, boom, let's get it out there. I'd much rather it be done in a slightly not super credible, slightly silly way, but yet still very effective within the episode than had some kind of long exposition. So
exactly.
This is,
like,
I'd much prefer this.
I would much rather have this scene than have Victor Klemper tell us that this was something yeah. that happened or whatever. You know, I mean, I yeah. think it's very effective that they're in this room by themselves. They're finding it yep. out, just the two of them, in this yeah. really sort of dramatic way. And I think that's really cool and interesting. And I think it's a great little scene and very interesting information and a good way to tell
it. All about the files.
Yeah, all about those lots and lots of files.
Lots and lots of files.
I think people tend to forget this little scene where Mulder actually sees a UFO for the second time in this series. Yeah. Maybe even third if you yeah. count the little ones in Deep Throat. But I guess technically the one he saw in Deep Throat, his memory was washed, so maybe he doesn't remember it. But he very clearly sees a UFO yeah. lift off and take off. I mean, it could be nothing else.
Huge ship.
Yeah.
yeah. No, it's a huge ass ship. It can't be any. There's no indication that it's anything other than a UFO.
No, I mean, it's not like Duane Barry when we later find out it was a helicopter. Like, that's not what this yeah. is. This is something different.
Nope. This is a very plainly viewed ship at, you know, very low altitude.
And it's worth mentioning that he doesn't seem to tell Scully about it or mention it ever again.
No, at least not that we see, at least.
Right.
But yeah, no, for whatever reason, it's like, we'll talk about that later. I mean, I just kind of thought maybe he would have told her at some point when they were maybe escaping from the mine and making their way to the diner where they meet Skinner later. I don't know.
It is interesting, but though, because she
we
also...
We certainly don't see them discuss it.
She also sees what I think is pretty clearly aliens.
Yeah, I don't see what else they could be. I mean, you could at a stretch say maybe they're alien human hybrids, but they look like what we think aliens would look like. They definitely don't look human.
Right. And I mean, I think that, again, this is one of those moments where I can suspend my disbelief as far as Scully is concerned, because it's very clearly supposed to be far away. She's not really seeing them. She's just seeing shadows and yeah. hearing scuttering yeah. across the floor. And I mean,
and she drops her flashlight, of course.
Yeah. And so I can buy that. Okay, what she did see, she could probably easily hand wave away, as she does. Yeah. But we see it, yeah. you know, and we see what it is. It was same with the yeah. UFO. And so it's just another interesting yeah. thing to be like, it's just interesting to me when they choose to show. They land on a side, like they're like, OK, yeah. this isn't meant for you to sort of be like, what is this? What is that? This is yeah. very clearly this one thing.
This is yeah, this is not a particularly ambiguous scene, as so often no. they are on the X-Files. This is pretty clear what's going on in a way, although I've never quite understood what is happening here. I mean, we're in the mine, lots and lots of files. Why are there aliens there exactly? I'm not quite clear on this.
I mean, I assume because the project is still going on, obviously, and yeah. they're still working with these alien colonists, presumably,
right?
And yeah. so they're there doing their somebody had to update Scully's file, right?
I guess so. They're just there to do their filing. They're like the alien admin assistants, mm-hmm. is what we're saying here. I yeah. like that idea.
And they're admin assistants. I love it. And they and either they Scully and Mulder's presence spooks them, or maybe the arrival of yeah. the cavalry spooks them.
Yeah.
Something spooks yeah. them, and then the ship essentially takes off with them.
Yeah.
That's kind of my take on it.
You're right. Yeah, no, I think that makes total sense. You're right, because, yeah. you know, they are working with the aliens on this kind of hybrid project, and so, yeah. yeah, it would make sense the aliens are kind of, maybe they're getting, helping themselves to some samples or updating right. some samples that are there, whatever.
They're still involved. This is a team effort.
Beautiful.
So that's kind of, I think that's my interpretation
yeah.
of what's going on.
No, that makes total sense.
So the next morning, it looks like, by the way, another prime opportunity for a fic, because what happened this night? Where did they go? What yeah. did they talk about? What
I
happened?
Mean, they escape the mine, right? Which to
yes.
me, they escape with really more ease than they ought to. But it's like, that's okay. We don't need to waste a lot of time.
Right.
I guess they just walk to this cafe. Scully's doing a lot of walking
no,
in these episodes.
I think it's the next day. I think they
it
went.
Is.
Yeah, they went somewhere and stayed the night. They would have had to.
Car? But they have no car, right? Because they get into Skinner's car when he comes to pick them up.
Well, I think maybe their car was abandoned at the mine, and they had
to. How did they get to the cafe? Is the question. How did they get to that diner?
You're right. A lot of walking.
I think they walked.
Hitchhiking. Maybe they appealed to some local campers.
It's possible also that diner is quite close to the mine because it's kind of the middle of nowhere, apparently.
But rustic.
You know, maybe it's not too far away. Maybe someone directed them to it or something like that. They do both look really tired. So it could be that they were just walking and hanging out in this diner all night. I don't know.
It's possible. And I did want to point out how adorable it is that like they aren't sitting across from each other like normal people would sit. They're scooched up real close next to each other.
They are scooched up real close, bless them. And neither of them are eating, even though they have food in front of them and they gotta be hungry, but they're just a little overwrought.
Yeah, definitely.
I understand.
But
the walking is exhausting.
It is a lot of walking. At least Scully has on very sensible shoes. That's nice
Thank
to see.
God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do enjoy the scene with Skinner. He is very clearly putting himself on the line for them again, which I enjoy seeing.
Yeah.
Essentially says like, well, I'm going to do what I can to protect you guys. And if they kill me, they kill me. Like that's essentially what he's saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause he says like, you know, I think that Mulder's, you know, questioning what, you know, how do you know they'll honor the deal? And Skinner says, I'll go state's evidence and testify or they'll have to kill me too. And I love the way Mitch Pileggi delivers that line. It's just like, you believe him. It's just very powerful.
And he's very confident in his plan, I think.
He is very confident in his plan.
Which I wonder if he, when and if he told Mulder what the plan is. Like, because I feel like Mulder kind of leaves this scene slightly downtrodden and slightly empty-handed. Yeah. And it would have been nice of Skinner to be like, but don't worry, I got this plan up my sleeve. It's all gonna be good. Like, and I wonder when that conversation happened, or if Skinner was sort of obviously keeping that close to the vest because he wasn't sure if it was gonna work or not.
That's possible. Yeah.
But I would like to see the scene where he tells Mulder what happened because which
they may have done in the car immediately because they were driving back together. So he may have told fairly quickly. I would like to think he told them, but. Obviously, for us, the viewer, we're not allowed to see that because it has to be a surprise for us. So
it's
that's okay.
True. Yes.
But yeah, there's ample opportunity for Skinner to tell Mulder what the whole story is after that.
Yep. Yep. So we're back with Krycek and his good old buddy Cardinal. And all I wrote about this scene was Krycek's haircut. Wow.
He looks terrible.
It's bad.
I just hate his hair in this episode. It's just so bad.
And again, with the denim.
Oh, my. There's a lot of, I mean, Luis Cardinal, they're all wearing very 90s jeans. Yeah. They're all kind of wearing mom jeans. Let's just say it and I'm like, wow, did we really dress like that? And we really did. So
we definitely
it's
did.
It's pretty hilarious.
Oh my God.
But honestly though, what's Skinner doing walking around with a digital tape in his pocket that they can come and just take it? Like, come on, Skinner, you got to put that thing somewhere safer than that.
Yeah. I don't know. Like the whole thing seemed a little like, of course that would happen. You know what I mean? Like, of course that would happen. But,
you know, it makes it exciting, of course, you know, the way it works out that, you know, of course, CSM thinks he's getting the upper hand and he's not. So it's just, you know, that's just the way it goes to the plot.
It keeps Krycek very much in the game, which I enjoy. So it's good.
It's all right. So it's fine. I like the fact that when Skinner shows up at the hospital, he's not wearing his glasses as though like he's already like half expected to get into a fight. So he's just ready to fight when he's like going around without his glasses on. He's in his fighting state just in case.
Oh, my gosh. I'm trying to look for Krycek and his mom jeans because I just think it's so great.
I feel like him and Luis Cardinal in that scene where they're sort of stopping at the store right before Krycek makes a run for it from the bomb. They're both like in that scene. You can see kind of the very sort of 90s jeans that both of them are wearing and kind of that light denim as well. Very sort of on trend for that time.
And I have to say, these are like the most incompetent assassins ever. Like, They're like, do you want anything? You good? You good? And then like he walks in and he's kind of like looking back at him. Like, could you be any more suspicious?
Like, yeah. Like, oh, because I think they had him fooled up until that moment. But it's that looking back. Yeah. And like, oh, we got him.
Like, if you hadn't looked back, he would have been dead. Like, come on.
Yeah. Honestly, like idiots.
But Krychek gets away with the tape then. Correct? Yeah.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
That's kind of the little missing piece that we need for later, which is fun.
Yeah, we don't know that yet at this point, but we just know that he got away.
Right.
And he's crowing about it to CSM.
And CSM is not in a good state right now. He's in a bad position. He is out of, like, he is losing his grasp on his power on anything. He is holding no more cards, which I think is funny because he's like, to Skinner, he's like, you can't play poker if you don't have any cards. I'm like, shut up. You got nothing.
I mean, throughout this episode, we can see like, I mean, throughout both of these episodes, he's just lying to the syndicate up and down the yin yang. And after a while, they really have caught on that he's lying. You know, they don't believe that he has the tape, which he doesn't. They don't really believe Mulder's dead, which they soon find out that he isn't. Mm-hmm. There's just lot, and you know, having taken care of the whole thing with, you know, Krychek and all of that, that he messed that up. He's lying about that too, like just bald-faced lying right in front of the group while he's talking to Krychek. He's lying up and down the yin yang, and he's not even getting away with it. So no. He's on very shaky territory with them, which is what's driving him for the rest of this episode. He's getting very desperate by the end of this episode, which is enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, I do love, though, so much how their Smoking Man and Krychek's dynamic just changes here. It's just really interesting, and it's especially later, like, the two of them have such an interesting tête-à-tête. Is that the word I'm looking for? They're like playing with each other like constantly throughout the rest of at least the next few seasons next couple seasons, and it's just really fun how this is sort of the turning point and they end up or like at each other's throats like in every following episode, which is fun. But he's still like working for him, but he hates him, and like I really enjoy that. It's a very interesting
relationship. It really is. I mean, Krychek is such a complex character, and so is CSM, really. So yeah, them together, it's very interesting.
Yeah,
they always have interesting interactions.
Yeah, I just really like their relationship. Their you know, not good relationship. Their tenuous relationship. Before we talk about the, you know, greatest scene, there's two great scenes coming up, but I did want to just talk about some brief little mentions of mythology stuff so that we can just probably refer back to it later. Well, they talk about the smallpox vaccinations, which is very important because they talk about that repeatedly. My understanding of this is that they were the purpose of them, or at least not maybe not the purpose, but what they used them for was to gain access to the human DNA so that they could use it for their hybrid experiments, correct?
Yes, that's what I understand. I mean, well, Manicured Man is, there's like quite an info dump from him, right? When they encounter him in Victor Klemperer's greenhouse, which I love that scene. There's like, it's raining on the greenhouse. Yeah. It's just very cool. And he tells them a lot. That is a long bit of exposition. Mm-hmm. But to me, you know, not at all dull, because largely because John Neville is so good.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I took from it, is that they were taking samples, and I guess that they were telling the people who were taking the samples that it was for the purposes of being able to identify bodies in the case of a nuclear war, which, I mean, that seems like a really poor excuse, because like I don't know if I'd buy that, because it's like, really, we're going to try to identify everybody based on their DNA? Okay. That's my understanding. They were telling the sort of the government people that were doing this, who they didn't want to know what was going on, told them that was the reason they were taking the samples. But in reality, they were taking them for the alien-human hybrid experimentation that I think largely Victor Klemperer was working on. It seems to be the implication.
Yeah, definitely. And they also, another mention that I wanted to bring up was they bring up Mengele, that the scientist or whatever. But I just think that's so funny because I always think of Reggie when I think of the Mengele effect. And I literally say that now because did you forget about that? I have been effectively turned into thinking it's the Mengele effect. It's true because I know that it's the Mandela effect. Like, I know that's what it's called. Yes. But I have become a victim of it because now I always say the Mengele effect. I don't know what that's about. I really don't.
That is hilarious. I forgot about the Mengele effect. Now I'm going to do it. It would have been better if I had forgotten about it because now it's going to happen to me too.
I really, the other day, had this conversation with somebody where they were saying the Mandela effect. And I'm like, no, it's the Mengele effect. And they looked at me like I was crazy. But I guarantee they're going to go on and they're going to say it too. Like somewhere down the road.
It's like some kind of a weird virus that gets into your brain that it's like you can't think of it as anything else.
No. And suddenly that's what it is. It's like, it is crazy. It is real and crazy. And I had to bring that up because it's insane.
Mengele shows up a couple of times in the X-Files, and this is one of them. Conversation in the greenhouse.
Oh, yes. Well, and one more thing, while Manicured Man says that tracks, is that Bill Mulder was forced to give up Samantha as insurance, which essentially is like part of the truth, because the truth is that they all did. But I mean, again, you can chalk it up to him. He's just telling Mulder what he needs to know or what he wants to know.
Right.
And then later, you know, we learn more pieces of the puzzle. So it still tracks while it's not necessarily.
It's close enough.
Yeah. It's not necessarily clear that was the plan from the start, but it definitely still tracks. It makes sense. It makes
not
sense.
Too far off.
Because, I mean, that was what they were all forced. They were all forced to give up their family members as insurance. So. Yeah, makes sense. So,
makes sense. It works.
Yeah. So, two final great fantastic scenes. So, first of all, let's talk about this Skinner CSM scene, which is, God, one of my favorite scenes in this whole series. It's such a good scene.
So good.
I just love powerful, domineering Skinner. Let me tell you, I enjoy it a great deal. Yes. Mm-hmm. Especially when, like, Mulder's not around to distract me. So
we can just fully enjoy the Skinner powers, just the raw sexual energy coming off of that man.
Yes. Yes.
It's impressive. And I love it when he's just, you know, giving the smackdown on CSM. It's just so enjoyable.
You can tell, too, there's like a moment in his delivery where he's like, no, you shut up. Or he's like, you listen here. And I'm just like, oh, damn.
Things are getting good.
You're really talking to him like that. Yes, he really is. And we love him for it.
It's the first time that he does it. Because up until now, he's been, you know, kind of, he's always a little snarky with CSM. But at the end of the day, he's, you know, does what he's told more or less. But this is now we're seeing like what CSM is pretty taken aback by it, too, of course, that this is Skinner. He's getting the upper hand all of a sudden. And it's so enjoyable to watch.
And we get the iconic, no, this is when you pucker up and kiss my ass.
Just classic. Classic. I mean, I can imagine some actors wouldn't deliver that in the right way and it would just make you laugh. But something about it just makes me applaud instead. Yeah, so
you just want to cheer.
I'll never forget the first time I saw that line. It just filled me with such immense joy that to this day, the line continues to fill me with that exact same joy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Same.
So awesome. That whole scene is great.
And I also like the idea that, I don't know, I just like the idea that Skinner and Albert had like discussions that we didn't get to see. Like, I stan a Skinner and Albert friendship. Like, I want to see them. After this scene, like high-fiving each other, going out for beers. I mean, like, did you see that shit?
Them. Yeah. I'm loving them together because, you know, they have kind of this interaction at the hospital. And then, like, by the time this rolls around, they're fast friends, apparently. And I love all of it. And they both have the same goal in mind. They both want to screw over CSM. Mm-hmm. And they do it so very well together. And they just, the whole way, it's so well presented, the way it all unfolds when, you know, Skinner reveals, here's Albert Hochstein. You're screwed. It's so great. And, you know, the whole idea of, you know, he's memorized it and he's told 20 other Navajo people in the tradition of his culture, which is great. And that's like a callback to the monologue at the very start of like Blessing Way, where we're talking about, you know, things only exist as long as people remember them, something like that.
Yeah. Yep.
And so that's very cool as sort of a through line. And I mean, Alfred is badass in his own very awesome way. So Skinner is badass in the Skinner way. Albert is badass in his way. And them together, it's just brilliantly magical. I love them.
I have a little question for you before we move on to the final scene.
Okay.
Do you think it's possible
that
Smoking Man not only knows Albert from having, you know, had his cronies beat the shit out of him earlier in the episode, but do you think it's possible he knows him from the past?
I get the feeling that they might.
That they have a little bit of a history, right?
I think you mentioned it once before that, you know, Albert says something in Navajo the second that he sees CSM. That could be based on the fact that he just saw him earlier in this two-parter. But, either there's something actually between them on a personal level, or at the very least, they recognize what each other is in a sense. Like, that Albert recognizes that CSM is one of these corrupt, powerful white government members who have screwed over his people for centuries. And that CSM recognizes that Albert is one of these tricky little buggers that you think mean nothing, but in the end wind up fucking up all your plans because they're actually a lot more resourceful than you give them credit for. And he finds that extremely annoying.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there, I'm wondering what that means, because they don't have a translation for what he says, right? When he first comes out?
No, I don't think so. No, I've never, we're not aware of it. Translate.
In the transcript, it says Yat Valgala, which I don't know if that's just written out phonetically or if that's actually.
I assume that's phonetic, because I don't think that's, I mean, from the Navajo that were shown in the tapes, it's written very differently than that. So I'm assuming that's written out phonetically, but yeah, he says something and I don't know what it is, but I like it.
It's funny because when I type that into Google, it goes immediately to X-Files. Like, so I don't think it's
really?
Where it goes to the transcript. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
I used to think, and I'm not totally sure what I believe now, but I remember the first time I watched it, I automatically assumed that he was actually quoting some very important part of what's in the tapes.
Yeah.
To prove that he does in fact remember it and he does in fact know, and this isn't a bluff. And don't fuck with me. This is actually true.
I enjoy that idea because that he does seem very like alarmed at whatever it is that he says. So.
Yes. So I think it's possible that he's like, holy shit, that's
he's
actually from the tape. You're
bluffing.
You're not bluffing here. This is the real deal.
Yeah, I love it.
So I kind of interpret it that way, but I'd still be very curious what it is.
Yeah. Anyway, if anyone out there speaks Navajo and can tell us what he says, we would appreciate it.
We'd appreciate it. Yeah.
But yeah, it's just such a great scene. Such a great scene. But, you know.
And the way it ends, too, like, you know, Albert gives CSM kind of a look as he's leaving, and then Skinner gives him a look, and they give each other a look, and it just, I love it.
Yeah. It's just like a standoff, and it's left at sort of a stalemate, but at the same time, like, we know that a stalemate for CSM is a loss, so it's still a triumphant scene, and I enjoy that.
It's so great. Everything about that scene is perfect, and I could just watch it on a loop all day long.
Oh yeah, same.
Yeah.
Speaking of
perfect scenes,
Yeah. This scene, even though it's very heartbreaking and sad, a very sort of good Scully Mulder scene. Quite shippy. I enjoy the shippiness.
Quite shippy. Very shippy, I would say. I would argue it's highly shippy, highly angsty, ranks as one of my favorites for those two reasons.
Well, poor Melissa, we find out rather abruptly that she died. And I mean, I think that at the time, like, Albert sort of indicated that he wasn't hopeful, but she was still alive when we last left her. And so
it seemed like she was kind of, you know, not doing great, but, you know, not declining, certainly.
Right.
So it's a little bit of a shock at the end, I think, that she's dead.
It is shocking. And I mean, just the image of Scully sitting next to the bed that's empty is very gripping.
Very well done. And the way that is shot with, you know, Mulder and Scully kind of in silhouette in that hospital room, it's really beautifully done.
Yeah. This is a really great conversation that they have about justice and fate. And I mean, I'm not going to like rehash the whole conversation, but I do like the idea that they
said good.
It's a really great scene. It's just the two of them coming again to like he said in his vision, like they are bound together in dangerous purpose. Like this is their lot in life already at this point.
This is it.
And they're aware of it. And, it's funny because there's a nice little line in here where Mulder says to her, what we're looking for is in the X-Files. The truth is in there. And it's a really kind of nice way to transition into like DPO and all the other bullshit we're going to get into in season three. You know what I mean? Kind of like we need to just kind of keep pushing forward and keep doing our work.
Yeah.
And I like how they call back again to this at the end of My Struggle 3 in a very similar way. Like all of this crazy shit goes down with William. It's all personal and the Smoky Man, Scully's almost getting killed and all this stuff. And she says the same thing to him in the hospital.
Yeah.
She says the truth's in the X-Files. And I think that's such a great callback because then we just kind of move into the rest of the season where we're going to get all these monsters of the week and we're going to move on and we're going to keep looking for the truth. And I just think that's a really cool way to end the episode and a really neat way to end a mythology three-parter when we know we're now going to be transitioning into like the normal part of the season.
That's right. Yeah. Perfect transition and very credible and believable. Makes total sense. And I mean, you get to say the truth is in there, which is always great to hear a phrase like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love that whole conversation. Beautifully written. I love the music in it. It's, I love anytime they're talking about fate and the truth and all those big, big deals. It's great. And you really get the sense to me that this is like they are like equal partners in this quest now is kind of what I take from that scene where it's personal for both of them. For different reasons, you know, it's always been personal for Mulder because of Samantha, now also because of his father, and Scully, you know, it has become increasingly personal for her because of her abduction and now Melissa. And so they both have this shared sense of loss and the shared sense of purpose and that they feel very united. And I really love that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very cool.
Really, really great. Great mythology three-parter. It's just
fantastic.
This is the X-Files at its best. Absolutely.
It kind of is. I absolutely love it. And yeah, everything is just firing on all cylinders. The pace is terrific. There's a lot happening, but you're learning a lot at the same time. You know, I'm just like the right amount of confused the whole time, but it feels very satisfying the way it wraps up. And we'd learn a lot about what's going on. We'd actually learn quite a lot about the mythology in these episodes, maybe more than any other set of episodes. We'll see. But we just learn a lot of what's happening. And there's also just a lot of really interesting personal character stuff at the same time. And so that's a great balance that they strike. And that's why it's one of my favorite episodes, Paperclip. It's in my top 25. Somewhere in my top 10, I think.
Yeah.
And that's why, because this is everything the X-Files should be, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that another great thing about the mythology, I feel like we talked about this with, maybe it was with Paul, our interview with Paul Terry. I think that's who we were talking about this with, when we were talking about the scope of these mythology episodes and how it really makes everything feel bigger and more grand and more important. And yet they can counteract that with these really nice, like you said, intimate, emotional moments.
Mm-hmm.
I think that.
Yeah. Chris Carter's really good at that in his episodes of, I mean, really throughout the X-Files, all the writers are. And I really love that about the X-Files, because if it was just a sci-fi show, I probably would have lost interest at some point. But the fact that they can do such a good job of balancing the sci-fi mythology stuff with the sort of character, emotional stuff, it's really well done. And neither takes away from the other. Those two sides work really well together, and nowhere better than these episodes, really.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything else you wanted to say about Paperclip or about any of these episodes, really?
I don't think so. I think I just kind of praised them really quite to the hilt, and I stand by it. I've said it. These are like the pinnacle of the mythology for me. We'll see how things go from here on out.
Absolutely.
How I feel about the next mythology episodes as we go along. But when I look back, to me, this is kind of like these were the golden days of the mythology, and that I'm not sure anything was ever this good again. So we shall see.
Yeah. Well, thanks, you guys, for listening. Please let us know what you think about these episodes, all of them, Anasazi, The Blessing Way, and Paperclip. Tweet at us at XFD Podcast, and we will be back with you guys in another couple weeks with another episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.